ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And a big time return with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. We had a week away. We had a little bit of time to recoup, reset, and get ready for UFC Paris. We have Ciryl Gane taking on Tai Tuivasa in that main event, co-main event. Couple of the best middleweights in the world, Robert Whittaker taking on Marvin Vettori, number one, number two contenders in that division. And if you look at this, this is the UFC's first entry into France since MMA was legalized in 2020. And if you look at it,
if only Tom Dukinmoa was here to reap the rewards that he helped lay the foundation for.
Or Thibaut Goody. But Thibaut Goody actually did get the opportunity to compete under the big time banner, because back in May, Bellator made their debut over at the Accor Arena, where the UFC is going to follow with a big time card. You had Ryan Bader taking on Chuck Congo. It was the rematch. It was a terrible fight. Don't go back and watch it. Yoel Romero took on Alex Polizzi, knocked him out in the third round. But if you look at this card, Matt, I just want to throw this one out there to everybody that's tuning in. This show really was able to take shape back on Thursday of last week. Fights were added, fights were subtracted. There's been an actual total of 8 canceled fights or rescheduled fights. If you look over on Tapology, this card really thrown together. 7 debuting fighters: William Gomez, Jarno Ahrens, you've got Eileen Perez, Michael Figlak, Gabriel Miranda, a big time staple with Brave, even though it was only 3 fights. It was a good time. Abus Magomedov, and then you also have Christian Quinones. I know this is one of those cards that's probably going to fly under the radar for a lot of people until it comes up on Saturday, but it is so stacked. It feels like a Bellator card, a UFC card, and Dana White's Contender Series all thrown together.
That's why I disagree a little bit. I do think this card is going to get a lot of headlines, but only the main card portion of this card will, because this is a strange card. Like, the brightest stars burn out the fastest, and for this card, it is so top-heavy that I do feel like a lot of these other fights and a lot of these debuting fighters are going to get lost in the shuffle, because Tuivasa versus Ciryl Gane is as good of a fight as the heavyweight division can put on right now. And Marvin Vettori and Robert Whittaker have kind of reached this stage where they fought everyone else in the top 15. They've kind of beaten everybody else, so they have to fight each other at a certain point. Kind of surprised not getting 5 rounds of that fight, because that co-main event is going to be an incredible one. But I do feel like those two fights are going to get the, I don't know, spotlight that hopefully they deserve. But you're right. Out of the 12 fights on this card, there's really only about 4 or 5 that I feel like are really going to get sort of that mainstream appeal.
Well, we're going to have to see how it goes. And listen, we're going to throw it on over to our Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen. Let us know in the comments section who you have as a possible Fight of the Night. There's 12 fights on the card. You're not wrong till Saturday. Let us know in the comments, Fight of the Night.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
All right, first pick, shot out of a cannon. Charles Jourdain just had a wild fight against Shane Burgos, a few weeks ago? In a fight that most people thought that he won, but he lost. He's going to be taking on Nathaniel Wood, who just made his first turn out in about 22 fights. The 23rd happened to be his first ever fight at featherweight. He looked amazing against Charles Rosa. That was back at UFC London. Re-upping in Paris. I think this is going to be an amazing fight. Charles Jourdain has platinum blonde hair on Instagram. This is going to be a great one.
It should be an incredible fight. These are two fighters who I think everybody loves, but they both still have quite a bit to prove. They are sort of classified as action fighters still, and not necessarily, you know, top tier contenders. So I think this is going to be an incredible fight. And to see how good Nathaniel Wood looks against an actual top tier 145er. Beating Charles Rosa is a good starting block in your division, but still, going up against a guy like Charles Jourdain is a much different animal.
You beat an English Charles and a French Charles, and you're on the move, on the prowl mat. Our second pick, Nassourdine Imavov taking on Joaquin Buckley, tentatively scheduled for the prelims. I don't know if this is going to end up being like a prelim headliner to get people excited about the main card. This has no business down there. Joaquin Buckley's looking to try and break into the rankings. Nassourdine Imavov, of course, ranked, who just finished Edmund Shabazian, although that was about, 9.5 months ago. So this should be a very good fight. Joaquin Buckley's had a bit of a fun run, I guess, UFC so far. This should be a great fight.
Nassourdine Imavov and Sam Alvey had, the opposite kinds of dirt on the UFC. Sam Alvey was allowed to stay around forever and could lose every single fight. Nassourdine Imavov SpongeBob seems like he's going to be one of those fighters who has to win 25 fights in a row before he even gets the chance to fight somebody in the top 10. It is kind of strange matchmaking, but I think we all know just how good Joaquin Buckley is and just how explosive Joaquin Buckley is. So this is one of those weird fights where either guy could win, even though Imavov does seem to have the higher ceiling.
Maybe Nasruddin Imavov's got to change his nickname to Rocky Edwards and see what happens. Okay. And for Joaquin Buckley looking to continue the winning ways, let us know down below again in that comment section who you have as a possible fight of the night. Looking at a few of them out there, Benoit St. Denis taking on the debuting Gabriel Fly Miranda. That could be a fun one in the scrambles. We got a lot of great fights. You're not going to want to miss it. So when it comes to UFC Paris, again, 12 fights, 7 debuting fighters. As far as ranked fighters on the card, Gon and Tuivasa, number 1, number 3. Then you have Whitaker and Vettori, number 1, number 2. And oh, by the way, Nasruddin Imavov, ranked number 12. Matt, again, a lot of debuting fighters. I know we're excited about a lot of these debuting guys. But to me, the fight that I'm most looking forward to out of the debuting fighters, William Gomez taking on Jarno Ahrens.
It's a fun one.
Tentatively scheduled as a first fight on the card. But when you look up and down this one, are there maybe some fighters that are flying under the radar? Some people that, you know, maybe the average UFC fan isn't already excited about?
I think Nasrat Haqparast, John McDessie is a fun fight. Again, these are two guys who are a little bit more established, but I feel like they've both kind of been forgotten about at this stage of their careers. They have suffered their losses against some of the better guys in the division, but that is one of those important fights because the loser, it's probably it for them, for being honest, even with Haqparast. Like, he is a very promising fighter, but if you lose to John McDessie at this stage of his career, I can't really see ever getting into the top 15. So I think that's a fun fight because both guys really need a win there. A
lot of very, very good fights. We got a big week scheduled. Dana White's Contender Series Week 6 coming up this week. You're not going to want to miss that drop here on the channel. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. And a big welcome to the UFC, to a couple of debuting featherweights. First out of France, we have the Jaguar, William Gomez. He's going to be taking on Netherlands' own Jarno Ahrens. He's going to look to follow in the footsteps of like Alistair Overeem, Bas Rutten, Jermaine Durandamy. Matt, can you name any other fighters that are Dutch? I mean, Gegard Mousasi, former middleweight champ.
That's immediately who came to mind. I just keep on thinking, I am the Ream.
Yeah, and horse meat. But for Jarno Ahrens, great opportunity coming in on short notice. This fight really thrown together at the last second. And if we look at it and start off with William Gomez, I mean, he's a guy out of the MMA factory. So you're going to get those recognizable names like Nasruddin Imavov, Ciryl Gane that are also on this card. Maybe even Alain Badeau, if you want to go back that far. That guy had an awful UFC run. But if you do focus on it for Gomez, he was actually booked back in June to take on a guy whose 32-fight win streak was one of the most legendary runs in bantamweight history, a guy who had 2 wins over Uriah Faber for the belt, a guy who from 2012 to 2014, Joe Rogan probably dreamt about at night. I'm talking about Henan Barão. William Gomez was supposed to take on Henan Barão at Aris FC number 7. Unfortunately, Barão couldn't make the walk, so Gomez took on Jose Marcos on that one. But Matt, when I did really kind of focus in on William Gomez, I didn't know a damn thing about him. I had seen that he'd fought with Cage Warriors. He'd fought a little bit with Aris. So you expect that you're going to get a pretty good prospect coming in at the age of 25. So got to really do the deep dive on this guy. Found an interview that he did before that Aris 7 fight by Dennis Hadzevich over on his YouTube channel. So for those Francophones that are out there, maybe check that one out. But he kind of touched on the fact that he was really into athletics when he was a kid. But when he was in around the age of 13, he went to do 100-meter dash and he hurt his leg.
Oh no.
So he had to find something new. So his friend said, hey, I'm doing Sanda. You want to do Sanda? And out of that, a champion was born. Junior national champ with France in Sanda. Parlayed that one into MMA. His uncle's actually Gregory Babin. And if you don't know Gregory Babin, he's on a 7-fight win streak right now. Just knocked out Mike Shipman in May. So pretty good lineage to have in the family. Another good article that I read was with Eclectic Magazine, if you want to check that one out, on the background of William Gomez. But if you do look at just his record, the ones and the zeros, he does have a debuting loss to Saladin Palnas, you know, KSW 2-time champion of featherweight. So that one's all right. He's got a loss to Morgan Charrière. you know, your Cage Warriors former champ at featherweight, where he got caught in a heel hook and then his knee kind of popped or his ankle popped. So
like
he,
Danilo Gallinari in a FIBA game.
He did have to take about a year away after that one. But Matt, if you do look overall at everything for William Gomez from fight one to fight two, not necessarily the same fighter every time. Like in the Jose Marcos fight where he took that one again on short notice, it was supposed to be Barão. He just kind of kept his hands really low, waited to bait in his opponent. Then he tried to land that left hook counter, tried to land his kicks to the body, one of his best parts of his game. But again, in certain other fights, he's a little bit more aggressive. He tends to also really like to grapple for a guy whose background is in Sanda. So what did you make of William Gomez watching the tape?
I really like some of the things that I saw, but he does seem to have one fatal flaw in his style, and that's that he does tend to tense up when guys rush him. He is a really good fighter when he's the one leading the dance, when he's the one setting the pace, and he has really nice kicks. They are kind of slapping kicks. They're not necessarily like one-shot knockout kicks like you see from a guy like an Adesanya or like a Leon Edwards, of course, or a Kamaru Usman. They are more accumulation more than just sheer power, but he just threw a really nice kick to the leg, to the body. He's very fast with his kicks too, and he can double and triple up on them, almost like you see other fighters do with a jab. The thing about him though is he does try to do a lot of like trip takedowns from the clinch when fighters do rush him, because he doesn't necessarily have great boxing. He has good boxing and good hands, but again, boxing as a term isn't just, oh, do you have good power on your feet? It does have to do with some of the skill sets that you employ with your two hands, and that's the thing with Gomez. He does sort of tense up immediately. And then if you are fighting someone who's a good boxer, like Aaron's is, I could see him being able to get on the inside of his range, be able to deflect some of those kicks just by being so close to him. And then if William doesn't have much of an answer with his hands, I think he could struggle in that one range. But that is the interesting thing about William in this matchup. He's really good at long range with his kicks. And then when the fight does get into that close range and sort of the boxing and the clinch, he will go for a lot of takedowns, which are weird because he's got decent control, but he is light on top. Guys can pop up. He'll try to jump to the back sort of haphazardly, and he can make kind of rookie mistakes, if we're being honest, in that part of his game, even though it does seem to be a well that he likes to go to quite often. So I think this will be a really interesting fight, especially if Jarno can get on the inside, because let's say he is having a lot of success with his own boxing, and he's the one who can dictate whether or not the fight's on the feet or on the mat. I think this could be one of those, like, fight of the night, fight opening fights on the card.
It is a little bit of an odd one from Gomez. Again, billed as a Sanda fighter, if he's on the reverse, if he's backing up, he really does like to land a lot of those counters, but he does do this thing where if he's pushing off and if he's trying to close the distance, he'll load up, kind of like the Darren Till load up, and then he tries to land a right hook, and it's kind of an interesting one out of a guy that's not necessarily known as a power puncher. He's more of a death by a thousand cuts type of fighter, and if you watch his fight against Marcos, at the end, it was the weakest TKO I've ever seen. He's looking off in the distance, just like punching, like, ah, I better put my time in. This is the way that this fight's going. So if you do look at it for him, again, a little bit of a well-rounded skill set, a little complimentary is, you know, kind of the wrestling to the ground. His ground game's a little bit of a different story, but if we do focus on the fighter out of the Netherlands in Jarno Arens, really, really fun on the rewatch. And if you look at it for him, he's been very, very active of late. And again, the sexiest of record on the 5-on-in, 3-1-1, not necessarily, but if you do look at the level of competition that he's taking on, he is, of course, 1-1 against Mert Özyıldırım for the title over with NFC, that organization. And he did lose his second to last fight. You know, the judges all scored at 50-45 against him. He struggled in some of the wrestling exchanges, but if you do look at it for Jarno Arens, he does have a background in judo, and you do see that in a lot of his fights. His last fight out with Brave CF, I don't know if you saw it, that crazy like hip toss throw that he had. Like, he really does have it going on with his judo. But when I watch a Jarno Arens fight, he really does have some good offensive boxing. He really likes to push the pace. He's not a guy that relies a lot on his kicks, even though he does kind of stand ahead. He looks like he's going to throw a lot of leg kicks. He doesn't necessarily do that. But when I did kind of watch a lot of these guys' tape, when I look at Jarno Arens and I look at a fight that William Gomez had in the past that kind of matches up, Gomez's fight against Harilla over with Cage Warriors, Harilla looked like Sean Strickland, but with none of the volume. He just kept walking him down and getting really happy. And then doing nothing when he closed the distance, Gomez was able to figure that out, land the kicks, land some of his boxing from long range. But for Jarno Arens, Matt, again, I was very, very impressed by his boxing and his forward pressure in a lot of his fights.
And these guys are both massive for the weight class, too. Like, yeah. If they do stay around for a long time in the featherweight division, I do think that they could both have a decent level of success. Like, this would main event a contender series card. I feel quite comfortable saying that because I do think both these fighters are going to show promise at the UFC level. I'm not going to predict that they're both going to have, 15-20 fight UFC careers, but I do think the winner of this is facing a difficult enough opponent being either guy to where it gets the career off to a really good start. I just like William Gomez's ability to win in multiple different ranges in this fight. I don't necessarily predict a finish in this one because both guys move quite well on the feet, but I do think the kicks and the punches of Gomez are going to start to accumulate as this fight goes on. Now, if Arens can get on the inside as this fight goes late, let's say the volume of Gomez does start to falter just because he does rely a lot on his kicks, and of course those do require a lot of energy to throw, then I could see a world where Jarno Arens can sort of slip in at the end of this fight and have some success. But I really do like the game of William Gomez at only 25 years of age, too. And let's think about both these guys. They're both younger than 30, and it's not really that often we see promising people making their UFC debuts under 30.
Younger than 30, good level competition, championship experience by Arens. Like, this is a perfect fight, and a couple of guys that, yeah, I think they're going to stick around. You know, if they can pick up fights in the States, that'd be perfect for their careers. If you look at it for Jarno Arens and you want to go back and watch a highlight reel fight, watch him fight Max Koga where he lands the uppercut and he's already dead on his feet, and then he hits him with a left hand and completely floors him. That was really, really awful. If we do look at the odds for this fight, I actually laughed before we taped this one. I went, are you serious? Gomez open a minus 225, minus 210 right now. For Arens, open a plus 190, plus 170. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. They're a surprise to us, they're to you. Again, I was so surprised that Gomez is more than a 2-1 favorite. So I'll say Gomez over under 65%.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under. It's way over. So 503 total votes, 91% Gomez, 43% by decision, 47% by knockout for the 9% that didn't watch Arens' fights, 51% by decision, and 23% by knockout. Again, this all really does surprise me, but you're going with Gomez here?
That's the thing. I don't necessarily agree with where the odds are, but again, if I'm just looking at this fight as to who can win the fight in specific areas, I like Gomez at like kickboxing range on the outside. I like him up close if he does have to use some of that clinch work just to get takedowns. Again, I don't think he's going to be able to control Arens for a bunch of minutes on the mat, but they're good enough to at least win moments in the judges' eyes, and I do feel like with his volume, with his cardio, and with his takedown ability that he is a safe pick in this fight.
Yeah, I mean, on the short notice draw against Marco, where he's supposed to take on Brow, he wasn't high volume, which was kind of odd for
him. But he has been traditionally, which was odd to see. Right?
Yeah, he has been traditionally, but he was more hip to wrestle, which was a little bit of a surprise. I think wrestling against Jarno Arens is probably going to be a mistake. You look at his judo pedigree, you look at the fact that in certain fights, he's able to control on the mat. In that fight against Mert Özildirim in the rematch, he wasn't able to do it. And he also did get dropped in the second round of that fight. I didn't mention that. When he got dropped by a left hook really quick, and that was kind of it. I like Jarno Arens with the boxing. I like him in tight range. I like the knees out of William Gomez when it does get to that clinch position. But I do favor Arens in that. So this fight thrown in on short notice, I think Arens isn't a bad shot as an underdog in this matchup, especially where the odds are at right now. So I'm going to go with the Netherlands Jarno Arens in this matchup. Matt going with the Jaguar William Gomez. This is the fight that I got most excited about out of any of these debuting prospects. So if you can go back and watch some of the tape study, I know it's our job and it's not yours, but please do, because it was a lot of fun on the rewatch. We get some great fights on this card. Two top middleweights in the co-main event, two top heavyweights in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. For a lot of the fights coming up on this weekend's UFC Paris card, originally to be Argentina's Aileen Fiona Perez's debut against France's Zara Farron. Farron out on 10 days notice. Insert Switzerland's Stephanie Egger, looking to do the damn thing. And if you feel like you just saw Stephanie Egger fight, well, you did at the start of August. Then I'll throw it up there on the screen, because Stephanie Egger, after the fight, still not happy with the fact that there was a tap, or was there a tap? I mean, did Alistair Overeem feel that tap against Stipe Miocic?
I clearly felt a tap.
He clearly felt
it. I've done the Alistair voice twice already. I feel like he might come after us.
She said, I didn't tap, and Also on the replay, you couldn't see anything. So listen, seeing is believing and ghosts are real. And for Stephanie Edgar, didn't necessarily tap. But she's going to take this fight on incredibly short notice. And we all know the judo pedigree of Edgar, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu pedigree, the ADCC experience where she lost at the pinnacle to one Gabby Garcia, a person that I would never want to face inside the octagon or in a grappling match.
Well, good news for you, Craig. USADA exists, and I don't think Gabby Garcia can make 135 or 145.
Do you think I could make it?
You could probably make... You definitely weigh less than Gabby Garcia.
Oh.
If I could make any guarantees on this channel, it's that Gabby Garcia outweighs you by at least 70 pounds.
Well, for Stephanie Edgar, the one thing she does have that you can't take from her inside of the UFC, she has a performance bonus over one Jessica Rose Clark. And you got to see how good the defensive grappling was in that fight. Jessica decided, I'm going to wrestle. Stephanie decided, well, that's exactly how you play into my game plan. So for Edgar, we know that to be true. She very much is a single striker. She likes to throw her right hand out there as a punch to then try and lock you up like it's a hockey fight and then get into the clinch, drag you down to the mat, and so on and so forth. But as everybody might already know Stephanie Edgar, they don't already know Eileen Perez, and she very much is about those dunks, Matt. That is very much the part of her fighting career. She's 7-1 in her MMA career, but if you go over to her Instagram, she's kind of like Sean O'Malley. Undefeated 8-0 is in her bio. Her lone loss is due to illegal knees. Now, she did land an illegal shot right to the groin area of her opponent earlier on in that fight. Her opponent screamed out in pain. Eileen Perez kind of gave the, why are we stopping this fight? And then as the fight goes on, she lands illegal knees as her opponent's hands are to the mat. And her opponent's like, hey, you can't do that. And the referee goes, hey, the fight's over. And Eileen Perez didn't see it. If you go back and watch that fight, Matt, this is where this video gets a little bit squirrely. Okay. I brought a prop in here. The mat is literally the foam tiles that I use in my basement to put my my workout bench down. That's what the mat is. They're fighting in a gym. Now, she is the Samurai Fight House champion over there at Bantamweight. The level of competition that she's taken on throughout her pro career is very, very, very porous. 0-2, 0-1, 0-0, 0-0, 5-5, 4-1. That was the illegal knee loss. 0-1-2, a lady who was 0-1 with two draws. Then she took on her last time out, a fighter who was 8-4, in Stephanie Bragg-Girac. And in that fight, for Stephanie, if you go back and look at her level of competition, the wins are over, people weren't very good. The losses are to fighters like Caitlin Chookagian, among others. So it was really a weird rewatch. But for Eileen Perez, Matt, the level of competition is not that good. She's been quite good. If you go back and watch her fight, she's fairly well-rounded, wouldn't you say?
And she's really aggressive, too. And that's the thing about Stephanie Edgar. Like, she takes what you give her, but it's never comfortable to watch because she normally has to fight under her opponent's terms. Now, she's a very good grappler, so she can pull off a lot of these spectacular finishes. But I feel like Stephanie Edgar and Paul Craig share, like, a unique experience on this earth. And it's, hey, we're losing most of the fight until we win it. And that's really good when you do win the fights. But I don't know if I've ever predicted a Stephanie Edgar fight correctly, if I'm being completely honest. Like, maybe your last one I did, but other than that, I don't know if I've ever gotten anything about her career right. And that's the thing about her in this fight that I don't necessarily enjoy. I know we normally talk about the odds a little bit later on in the episode, but
can you give me my due then?
Yeah, here, talk about the odds.
Edgar opened quickly at a -145. Again, on 10 days notice.
Who the fuck's betting that much money on Stephanie Edgar?
She opened -145, -331 right now. For Eileen Perez, open +125 at a +258. And the one thing I want to say before I throw it back over to you, Eileen Perez, I mean, she's been signed to the UFC for months and months and months now. She signed back in May, so it's been a long-awaited debut for her. All of this is a surprise to me. You got to give her somebody that's unranked. Now she gets Stephanie Edgar instead of Zara Farron.
Short notice.
She would have beaten Zara Farron. We got to get that one out of the bag right now. This fight is earmarked at featherweight, so Edgar, she is a bantamweight naturally. Eileen Perez, also in and around bantamweight, so they're going to give that 10-pound allowance up at featherweight. But again, Stephanie Edgar, a giant favorite, and it's a little weird.
Yeah, like just for the sake of kind of brainstorming a path to victory for both fighters, Like, Stephanie Egger did get outmuscled by Tracy Cortez, who's really a 125er who's kind of blown up to 135, if we're being honest. Do you think Egger could struggle with the physicality at 145 and that kind of be the lead to her downfall? Because, I'll be honest, off her back, I like her in this matchup. She's the better grappler, especially with her own offensive jiu-jitsu. I think on the feet, Perez does throw shots with a lot of power behind them. She is good, especially offensively, in the clinch, which isn't necessarily a part of your game that you want to work on all that much if you're fighting someone like Stephanie Egger. So, other than the fact that Perez might be able to go in there and just completely outmuscle Egger, I'm finding it difficult to figure out, okay, how does Perez go in there and have sustained levels of attack against Egger?
She's a much better striker. I mean, again, if you go back and watch the tape, it's all on YouTube.
I think they'll just get her into clinches, though, a lot is the big problem with that.
Samurai Fight House puts every single fight out there on YouTube, so you can go back, you can rewatch every single Eileen Perez fight, but if you go back and watch, she will fight behind a jab. She throws all of her power in her right hand. She'll throw some kicks, but she likes the clinch to take the fight down to the mat to then try and implement ground and pound. It could be jiu-jitsu, but she very much is about trying to soften up her opponent to really pass into some favorable positions. Eileen Perez fights are a lot of fun to watch. And again, as I mentioned, May 31st, 2022, UFC roster watch threw it out there that the UFC had signed her. And I went, what? Why? Really? Like, this is the one, this is the fighter that we're going with? Again, fighters out of Argentina, you've had fighters like Santiago Ponzinibbio. And then there's the field, the Luis Eduardo Garrigoris and such. So the odds are a little bit strange. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 80% Stephanie Egger.
I'll say under, but who knows? I'm just thinking, like, how long is the flight from Argentina to France?
Probably
quite That'd be
long.
A tough one. Like, Perez might have some legit jet lag if she's not there 2 weeks in advance.
All right, that's have a look at the votes. They are under 549 total votes, 65% Egger, 50% by decision, 42% by submission, 8% think she's going to knock her out. For the 35% that have Perez, 72% by decision, and about 19% by knockout. So, Matt, the odds have Egger, the fans have Egger. Do you have Switzerland, Stephanie Egger, on 10 days' notice?
Well, if I pick her, she's going to lose. And if I pick against her, she's going to win. So it's weird because I do think Perez can have success in this fight. Now, I don't think I've ever been sold on Stephanie Egger. And hey, she might come back to prove me wrong again. It's happened before. So I'm going to ever so slightly pick Stephanie Egger, but I do not have a lot of confidence in the pick, and I don't like her for the odds whatsoever.
I'm going to go with Stephanie Egger, and my reason behind all of this is Eileen Perez, she will strike. She definitely throws a lot more volume with a lot more intent than Stephanie Egger does. When it does come to the grappling positions, obviously you saw Egger just lose to Maeda Buena Silva in one of those positions. Or did you?
But Myra's good.
I don't know. But Maeda Buena Silva is very good and established. For Perez, I haven't seen it yet. If Perez gets a win over Stephanie Egger, it's more much-needed tape study against a much higher-level competition than what she's been facing down good in Brazil. Point. So for me, I do have Stephanie Egger. I think the jiu-jitsu, the judo, it can win out in this specific matchup. But we'll see what happens coming up this weekend. So both of us going with Switzerland, Stephanie Egger. Main event. You have Tai Tuivasa really looking to challenge against the former champ in Ciryl Gane. In the co-main event, former champ Robert Whittaker taking on former challenger Marvin Vettori. It's a great weekend of fights. I can't wait for it. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, a fight where I could go six ways to Sunday with this one. We have Germany's The Warrior, Khalid Taha, taking on the debuting Problema, Christian Quinones, is a guy who got a great win over on Dana White's Contender Series last summer, and he's looking to parlay that into a successful UFC career. But if you look at it to start off with Khalid Taha, he's 1-3 with a no contest that was originally a third round submission loss to one Bruno Silva, but it was overturned due to some USADA black magic for Bruno Silva. So it's considered a no contest on the record of Khalid Taha. So he's 1-3 with a no contest on the UFC stage since his debut in July of 2018. His last win was in April of 2019 over one Boston Salmon, a man who went 0-2 in the UFC with two knockout losses. So for Khalid Taha to really try and get ready for this one, he was originally supposed to take on a returning Taylor Lapolis coming up this weekend. I was excited about that fight. Lapolis out and Christian Quinones in on short notice. The fight was announced on August the 24th. So very short notice, as a lot of the fights on this card were. Now, originally, Christian Quinones was getting ready for a fight against Yusuf Zalal back a few weeks ago. Quiñones was forced to withdraw, so he gets this opportunity coming up this week. And if you do look at it for both these guys, we've seen some bright spots for Khalid Taha in the UFC in just small pockets. And for Christian Quiñones, we've seen him in the corner of a former UFC fighter, in the corner of his brother. His brother is a guy that we talk about way too much on this channel, Tecco Quiñones. I mean, wow. A real world beater, Tecco Quiñones was. They were fun fights while they lasted. Against Sean O'Malley was fun for a bit. The fight against Lewis Smolka was fun for a little bit. But Matt, for Christian Quiñones, it was a lot of fun to go back and watch tape on him. Obviously, he had a lot of experience on the regional scene over in Mexico. Experience against a decent level of competition. I mean, the fight against Donny Matos that he had over with UWC, that was a title fight. Donny Matos has fought a lot of, you know, decent competition. Matos actually lost to Christian Quiñones and knocked out Wilson Hayes in under 20 seconds. So Wilson Hayes, he fought for title in the UFC. But Matt,
he did, on Big Fox.
I know you enjoyed watching Christian Quiñones' tape. What can you tell us about him?
This is a really weird fight because one of these fighters is going to look awesome come Saturday. And then I got to be honest, I'm not sure how awesome either guy's going to look after this singular performance. Because for Khalid Taha, he reminds me a little bit of Chris Moutinho. I know that's a weird name to bring up, but he is durable and he gets into those kind of fights that are going to make you remember him. Because he is willing to eat a shot to give a shot. And he is going to rely a lot on some of his own heavier boxing combinations. And if he is going to land them, he'll have a ton of success. And the thing is, no matter who he fights, whether it's Piotr Jan or whether it's Mir Craig, it is going to be in that fun style just because, again, he is willing to eat some shots to give them. Against Quiñones, though, it's going to be interesting because I do think Khalid Taha is the much more powerful athlete between these two. If he able to get on the inside, he does have good hooks if he is able to land them, but that is the really frustrating thing. We've only seen Khalid Taha, especially his last two times out, against guys who were definitely going to beat him. I think that's fair to say. I know he made a good account of himself, but still, you could always tell that he was a step behind because if Taha's not having a ton of success with his striking, and he's definitely getting out wrestled, there's not really a path to victory for him in a lot of these matchups. And against Christian Quiñones, it'll be interesting because Khalid Taha does not have the worst offensive takedowns. He is one of these fighters who, offensively with his wrestling, he can have a little bit of success. He does have to fight at a very close range, so it is just kind of there for him if he does decide to go for it. Now, if he is on the receiving end of any takedown attempts, I do worry about his ability to just move his feet because I think that's where his poor takedown defense comes from. He's someone who does like to plant and throw with a lot of power. And the thing is, when you plant, it gives your opponent a great opportunity to duck under and take you down.
Like, when I was watching Khalid Taha tape, obviously, again, 1-3 with a no contest in the UFC. The no contest was originally a loss by submission to a guy who's quite small and compact in Bruno Silva. I mean, he is a flyweight. My God, do I like watching a Bruno Silva fight, either at middleweight or the guy that's a flyweight. But if you watch Khalid Taha, he does like to just bite down on the mouthpiece and throw. When he fought Boston Solomon, when he landed that hook, that left hook, knocked him out, and he was an underdog in that fight. So good win for Khalid Taha. But when he's been taking on these guys, like Sergey Morozov was a lot better than Khalid Taha, and he had a lot of success with the wrestling, and he was able to hold him down and chain together takedowns. When Taha fought Jaime Barcelos, you're going to go, well, Craig, that was a fight of the night. Yeah, on paper it is. Like, for some reason, some sick psycho decided Jaime Barcelos doesn't fight very often. Let's give him and his dance partner $50,000.
Like, Alicia Zaleski and Benoit Saint-Denis, I'm pretty sure, won fight of the night, too. And that was a one-sided. Like,
Chris Moutinho, Sean O'Malley was a fight of the night. But there was a guy in those fights that was the hammer, and one was the nail. And Khalid Taha, all three judges scored at 30-27. Barcelos had him hurt at multiple occasions. He completely out-volumed him. He landed takedowns. It wasn't good. So I thought, okay, how can I look at this fight objectively and give everybody at Fight Night Picks kind of a good view of this one? So I went back and watched a lot of Khalid Taha fights when he was on the come up, when he was young, when he was hungry, because he still is relatively young. He just doesn't fight very often. So I watched this fight over with Ryzen when he took on Ishihaba. And in that fight, he got taken down really quickly and he got into some really poor positions. Then he was able to get himself back up to the feet. He lands some of those giant follow-up shots, knocks down his opponent, and he's able to get the win. So he did look very impressive in that one. When he's taking on Christian Quiñones, who we haven't touched on yet, out of Mexico, this guy out of Entram Gym. So you recognize, again, big names in the UFC. We've had a huge crossover. A lot of Entram Gym fighters on Dana White's Contender Series, like La Malvada, Silvana Gomez-Juarez, or, of course, Brandon Moreno. But when you watch him fight, very well-rounded. Now, some sites have him as 16-3. We have him as 17-3. Sherdog has him as that. I think the UFC switched over to that. But when you do watch him fight, he fights on the outside and doesn't really like to go on the inside very often. So what did you make of the tape study of Quiñones?
I do really like some of his boxing combinations. And he is somebody who will finish up a combo with a kick, almost like Holly Holm against Ronda Rousey. Weird comparison, but still, just one that a lot of people would know. And I do think that's where he's going to have to try to have a lot of his success. But this fight, more than any on the card, comes down to what range is the fight contested at. Because if Khalid Taha can get on the inside, I do think he can have a ton of success with his power shots. The weird thing about Taha is we've seen him rocked in a number of fights at this point, and if Quiñones can hurt him from the outside before Taha can even start with his own boxing, then I do think Christian Quiñones, he has a good finishing instinct. He's someone who will try to burn his gas tank. Like, he's not really cut from the Jeff Neal cloth. He's not somebody who is going to stay very disciplined and composed and try to single shot you. He will really go for it. Normally I would say that's a negative, but against someone like Khalid Taha, I do think it could lead to him getting him out of there really quick if he is able to chain together some of those strikes from the outside. But again, Khalid Taha has been an interesting character because some of his skills are very high quality, I would say. We just haven't really had the chance to see them shine yet because of his level of competition up until this point. A guy who failed a drug test for, again, you guys know us. We don't really care when someone has a no contest due to weed, okay? It doesn't matter to me,
but
at least.
Bruno Silva was.
He was on that real stuff, though. So, you lost to somebody who had a genuine USADA suspension, and two fighters who were, let's just be honest, much better than you. And those never really should have been made matchups to begin with. I think Khalid Taha has a great opportunity this weekend to sort of erase the bad memories that a lot of people have from his career up until this point. Because for Quiñones, you're right, he is well-rounded, but he is sort of a master of none, and I think that could come back to bite him.
Oh boy, that's rude.
No, not at all. You can't be a jack-of-all-trades and specialize in absolutely everything in the game. For Quiñones, I do think he will struggle on some of those in-betweens, especially up close. If he can get his own offensive takedown, and again, if there's ever a fight to do it, this would be the one. I think he could have a lot of success with it. I just don't know if his wrestling's good enough from that outside to really be able to telegraph them and get in.
Well, the odds on this fight, Khalid Taha, open a minus 150 favorite, minus 141. One right now for Christian Quiñones, open plus 130, plus 117, so the odds closing in on par. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised us there to you. I know that Christian Quiñones is the underdog. I'm willing to say that the fans have Quiñones in this one.
Agree.
I'm going to say over under 67.5% Quiñones.
I was going to say 65, so I'll say under slightly.
Say under slightly. It's over slightly. 536 total votes, 78% Quiñones, 83% by decision. 8% by knockout for the 22% that have Taha, 59% by decision, 29% by knockout. So some more of the fans thinking that Taha could win this one by knockout. I would think that, you know, if he's going to win by knockout, decision, probably not by submission. Who are you picking in this fight?
I don't love the fact that I'm about to pick Khalid Taha in a video, but I do think his experience up until this point is going to help carry him over in this fight. Again, I like his boxing on the inside. He's not the easiest guy to hit clean unless you are able to hit him with a lot of volume. If you can throw a lot of volume at him, it is going to open up some of his attacks. But if you can get on the inside first and do some of his own damage, he's someone who you kind of have to rely on those up-the-middle attacks to really hurt because he keeps his head very compact, his shoulders very high. So I think if Khalid Taha is going to get another UFC win, it's going to be this weekend. If he loses this fight, you'd have to imagine it's over for
him. I like the volume out of Christian Quiñones and the well-roundedness in a matchup like this. I think from the outside, he's going to be able to have some success. Now, again, Taha's got to close that gap, land with power, and obviously you've seen that happen in the past on his way up into the UFC. Not to say that it can't happen this weekend. I do like the skill set out of Christian Quiñones. His brother had a run in the UFC. I mean, he went to an Ultimate Fighter finale, so there is that, but I'm going to go with Problema Christian Quiñones to get a UFC victory on short notice. Matt going with Khalid Taha, who already had a fight booked originally this weekend against a longer rangier guy in Taylor Lapolis. So should be a great fight. We're split on the pick. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. We have 12 good fights coming up on this card. Two really great ones up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Weekend, a fight at lightweight that was originally supposed to see France's God of War, Benoit Saint-Denis, taking on Christos Yago. Scratch that record because on August the 15th, on short notice, announced by Big Marcel Dorf over on Twitter, the fact that Gabriel Fly Miranda is going to step in on short notice, make his UFC debut, the fighter out of MMA Masters, a fighter that Brave Combat Federation sold me a bill of goods on. and I'm still waiting for him to deliver. For Gabriel Miranda, he has that lineage in his back pocket, as does Benoit Saint-Denis. Now, Saint-Denis had a lot more success over there. Again, Miranda, 2-1 with that organization, but it was a fun rewatch on the fights for Gabriel Miranda. Now, the first thing I'm going to show up there is the fact that for Gabriel Miranda, if you look at his last fight and you just click on the event, it was, It was Face the Danger number 23. He took on a fighter that was 5-5. Matt's having a problem.
I don't know what's going on right now, but I cannot stop tearing up my left eye. I'm professional, though, so we can keep going.
And for the audio podcast listeners, they've really been thrown for a loop. But if you click on Gabriel Miranda's last fight against one Diego Squieria, if you click on Face the Danger 23, I'll say it one more time. It says right at the top, a prompt from Tapology, this promotion has been flagged by Tapology, promotion pattern of record padding and mismatches. Unless further evidence emerges regarding the legitimacy of this organization's event, any new bouts to this promotion will be similarly flagged, as will the Tapology
records. You're telling me Face the Danger isn't on the up and up?
I'm just telling you that. Gabriel Miranda, I'm very excited about him. You look at his record, he's 16-5, 15 of his fights by submission. This guy is, of course, a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. And if you go back and watch his fights, he is super slippery on the mat. It doesn't matter who he's fighting. It could be Joe from the grocery store. It could be Benoit Saint-Denis.
Could be.
He really does put it all out on the line. His striking, he just walks forward and throws the kitchen sink at his opponents. He does a lot of body lock trip takedowns, which work more in women's MMA than they do in men's MMA at the highest level. But you catch my drift. Gabriel Miranda is a very interesting fighter. He can get held down on the mat. He can struggle in certain positions. He is very, very slippery, though. But my God, has he taken on a paltry level competition on the regional scene.
He certainly has, and that's why this fight against Benoit Saint-Denis is going to be such an important one for him. Because I agree, his grappling does look phenomenal on the regional scene, but it's really easy to out-grapple guys who are 3-1, 0-0, 5-5. Like, those are the types of people we expect you to beat if you are eventually going to become a UFC-level fighter. And for Saint-Denis, he got a shit draw of the cards his first time around. Let's just call it what it is.
Short notice, up a weight class
against a dangerous striker with good takedown defense. Like, it's just not a great recipe for success if you're Benoit Saint-Denis.
But was the referee Vyacheslav Kislyov there to protect the fighter?
Not at all. He was there for, like, if Squid Games had a referee, this guy would probably be the ref because he was out for blood. Now, for Saint-Denis, he showed great heart in that matchup, and everyone was kind of concerned about how good he was going to look his second time out due to the amount of damage that he took against Zaleski dos Santos. But his last time out at 155 looked way better in his natural weight class, and that's the big thing about Saint-Denis. I don't think Miranda's just going to be able to have a ton of success on the mat against Saint-Denis, even if he's able to get him there, because Benoit Saint-Denis is an interesting fighter. He's almost like a volume striker, but with his grappling. He's someone who does like to scramble a lot. He's very fast on the mat. He will try to progress from guard to half guard to full mount and try to make real work done on the mat. But the thing is, against a guy like Miranda, if you are creating a lot of that separation, it might give him a chance to get his own sweep. So I think this could be a really fun grappling match. But I don't necessarily think either guy is going to win a lot of fights on the feet in their UFC careers. Like, for Miranda, he does leave massive openings when he does try to strike. So, let's say he ever fought somebody like Jalen Turner fights in this weight class, for instance. I know he's, like, a ranked fighter, but still, Jalen Turner would hit him 3 times and put him down from, like, 6 feet away, just because that's the type of fighter he is. And for Saint-Denis, he does blitz forward a lot. He does have really good activity on the feet, but again, he's someone who will also leave a lot of holes for really top-tier strikers to take advantage of. So, I think this could be a really fun fight if we get the best version of it, and the best version of this fight is a grappling-heavy contest.
Striking-wise, Miranda walks forward, throws a lot of volume, leaves his head on the center line. In the past year, he switched it up from training in Brazil to training at MMA Masters. A lot of UFC fighters have come out of there. Obviously, Daniel Valverde's great coach with that gym. For Benoit Saint-Denis, a guy billed out of Venom Team in France, that was a big deal. He's a black belt in judo. He was French Special Forces with the SAS. Brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. You watch Benoit Saint-Denis grapple. This guy just throws hammers of hooks, closes the distance, holds you down, and keeps you down. He's not a guy that leaves a lot of openings or space on the mat. Now, we'll see how that translates against Gabriel Miranda. We look at the odds. Saint-Denis open on best fight odds and average minus 188, minus 261 right now. For Gabriel Miranda, open a plus 150, plus 209 as it stands. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised to say to you, I remember getting those emails from Brave CF when Gabriel Miranda was with the promotion going, man, this guy's going to be something. And now he's in the UFC. And for Benoit Saint-Denis, I got those emails and thought, this guy needs some seasoning, but damn, he's pretty good. I'm going to say over under 70% Saint-Denis.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's way over. 938 total votes, 93% Saint-Denis, 38% by decision, 41% by submission, 14% by knockout for the 7% that are Miranda, 54% by submission. There's going to be some wild cards out there all week that are going to hit up the comment section and say, this guy has 16 wins, 15 of them are by submission. He's going to beat Benoit Saint-Denis. I'm going to take the lead on this one. Gaetano Perello had the look like Gabriel Miranda has, and he had a lot of knockout wins, and he was a very good striker. And then they matched him up with Ricky Simon, and then they matched him up with Douglas Silva de Andrade, and he got ground to a pulp in those two fights. I don't know if the same thing can be said for Gabriel Miranda. I think he's a very skilled fighter. I think Benoit Saint-Denis has those skills to beat Miranda in this specific matchup.
So do I. I think Miranda can have success in this fight, but the problem is Saint-Denis excels in a lot of the same areas that Miranda excels at, and I do feel like his game's a lot more suited to higher-level MMA than Miranda's is. I could be wrong. I've been wrong many times before. I will be wrong many more times in the future, but I do like Saint-Denis in this matchup, and I like him a lot more at this weight class, of course. Like, if he fights at 155, he's going to be the naturally bigger guy than a lot of his opponents, and I do feel like his game is tailored towards being slightly bigger, getting on top of his opponent like we had mentioned, so I do like Saint-Denis in this fight.
Saint-Denis with professional experience at middleweight, welterweight, quite a bit of experience at super lightweight, that one 165, and lightweight as well. It should be an interesting fight. Both of us going with Francis Benoit Saint-Denis to get the win. A big time card coming up this weekend. Vettori and Whitaker in the co-main event. Siddle Gunn taking on Taito Ivas in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. This weekend, a battle for the top 15 at middleweight. We have Francis Nassourdine Imavov taking on Numancia Joaquin Buckley in a great one. I mean, for Imavov, looking to hold that rank at number 12, a little bit of a surprise dipping outside of the rankings. And for Joaquin Buckley, a guy who's 4-1 in his last five fights, he's really set the world on fire in some of his recent performances. And if you look at it for Joaquin Buckley, I can go through the list, but his win over Antonio Ahoyo, a much bigger man, his win over Albert Duraev, where that eye swelled up like it did in the Roman Kopylov fight, only this time they decided to end it between rounds. For Buckley, I'd say his worst performance, probably split decision win over Abdulrazak Alhassan, probably left a little bit to be desired, or his quick enough loss where there was the exchange of the head kicks between Abdulrazak Alhassan, Joaquin Buckley, and Alessio Di Chirico. The hammer that night was Di Chirico. The nail was Joaquin Buckley. But we know Joaquin Buckley at this point. Very interesting southpaw. Loads up quite a bit on his shots. Loves to march forward. Loves to throw with power. The most viral fighter on the internet, so his Instagram says. But his win over Impa Kasanganai made him a feature, I guess, in a video for Kanye West drop. Joaquin Buckley, very interesting fighter. For Nassourdine Imavov, 3-1 inside of the UFC's octagon. Complete performance against Jordan Williams in his debut. Majority decision loss to Phil Haas, and one where Imavov had success with the striking, Haas had success with the wrestling. You look at it for Imavov, his last two times out, finish wins to get him into the rankings. One over Ian Heinisch, where he just continued to pour the pressure on, land the jab, bust up the face, finish him up against the cage. And his win against Edmund Shahbazyan got him into Mount of Crucifix, kept landing elbows. The referee said no more for Mr. Shahbazyan. So for both these guys, finishers to the nth degree, but they get it done in very different ways, and that's why I think this fight's going to be very fun.
I agree. I think this is going to be an incredible fight in the middleweight division, and between two guys who, again, they're well known in MMA fans' minds, but they do have a lot still to prove, because Joaquin Buckley has very obvious strengths, but there's massive weaknesses that come with his obvious strengths, and you had sort of alluded to them. He does load up a lot on his shots. Now, there's a give and a take to that, because when he lands his hooks, they are devastating. Like, he has incredible hand speed. He has really nice boxing combinations. But again, everybody knows what's coming before those shots come. And it's the load up, the fact that his chin's going to be very high in the air. Even think about how Kevin Holland beat him. Like, Kevin Holland waited. And then the second Buckley would load up on his shots, he'd make him pay for it pretty much every single time. Like, that knockout is a very, very nice knockout to go back and watch, because it's just Kevin Holland, who's by far the softer of the two guys when it comes to how heavy their hands come. Joaquin Buckley, it's like he's throwing sledgehammers, whereas Kevin Holland, it is much more volume the majority of the time, but Kevin Holland looked like the power striker in that matchup because he was just able to time Joaquin Buckley as he was coming in.
Now, for Buckley, took that fight on 5 days' notice, that should be said, but if you do look at it, he has 6 knockdowns in his 7 UFC fights. He's finished 6 of his 7 fights in the UFC. Win or loss, have finished by knockout. All 6 of those fights that ended by knockout, whether for or against, were performance bonus fights.
And I don't mean this to be disrespectful at all, and hopefully he takes this as a compliment if he is watching this, similar to who was watching our Contender Series.
Darius Flowers.
Good on you, Darius. Good on you. You won via WWE moves, but hey, that was pretty cool. Well, Joaquin Buckley reminds me of Jimmy Manoa. I think that's fair to say. Like, he's going to win by knockout, he's going to lose by knockout, and he's going to go out on a shield the majority of the time. And again, Jimmy Manoa, what was he good at? He had really good boxing. It would either give him knockout wins or give him knockout losses because of it. For Buckley, I can kind of see his career playing out in a very similar way to Jimmy Manoa's, to where it's going to be fun no matter what. I just don't know how sustainable this type of a career is. And even against a guy like Nassourdine Imavov, to sort of bring it back to this fight and less big picture stuff, Joaquin Buckley could land one of those big hooks on Imavov, knock him out. He can do that to any fighter in the division. Imavov's really good at moving backwards, though, and then fighting off of his own power punches. And if Joaquin Buckley thinks, oh, I'm going to be the bigger guy, I'm going to be the stronger guy, I'm just going to bully myself into range and land one of my big hooks, Nassourdine Imavov, his whole game is created around stopping guys who rely on that kind of a game plan. So I think this fight could be a weird one, where it could be fight of the night, but it could also be over based on the first strike that lands.
Well, for big picture, I mean, again, 7 fights in the UFC for Joaquin Buckley, has 6 knockdowns already, and he's number 6 all-time in the middleweight division UFC history for knockdown average per 15 minutes. Number 1, Drew McFedries, a blast from the past. So if we do look at this matchup for Nassourdine Imavov, I mean, well-rounded striking. He mixes in his kicks. He does like to throw in combination. Pumps the jab out there a lot. One, double up, triple up. I mean, Sir Mix-a-Lot would have fun with the way that Nassourdine Imavov fights. But the other thing that he does when he throws his right hand, he picks the power to land in that right hand. And it can come from a couple of different angles. So I do like that. If you do look at it, he had those wins over Heinisch and Shabazzian back in 2021. Also had the loss to Phil Haas. This is first action in 2022, and he gets the fight close to home. He's out of the MMA factory. So good look for him there. Obviously, he has 4 submission wins on his record. He is the more likely to mix in his submissions or try and get submission sweeps. He'd be the type to go for Kimura to try and sweep from bottom if Buckley does mix in his own wrestling. But when I do look at this one, for me, Joaquin Buckley does like to throw with a lot of power, but he will mix in some clinch positions. He will mix in a little bit of offensive wrestling. Joaquin Buckley struggles to stop the takedown. Nassourdine Imavov, for as good as he is with his submissions and his own wrestling, he also struggles to stop takedowns. So I do like this matchup quite a bit. I think it's going to be a lot of fun while it lasts. And for Imavov, he likes to stop takedowns with submission attempts. We saw that against Shabazzian, where in the second round, Shabazzian goes for the takedown. Imavov goes for the front headlock. And then out of that, he ends up and sweeps on top. And then he ends up getting that man of crucifix for the elbow. So we look at the odds in this matchup. Imavov open to minus 180, minus 260. Buckley open plus 155, plus 209. I look at that and go, well, geez, I think Joaquin Buckley's got a better than a, you know, a 2-to-1 shot to win in a matchup like
this.
Yeah, I actually do. We have a look at the Tapology votes, so Matt's not going to be surprised. I'm going to say over under 70% Imavov.
I think it'll be over.
It's going to be over? Slightly
not
over. 1,107 total votes, 76% Imavov, 29% by decision, 59% by knockout. For the 24% that have Buckley, 73% by knockout. You think Nassourdine Imavov wins overwhelmingly?
I do, because this is the thing. He's the much more refined fighter out of these two. The thing about Joaquin Buckley is he doesn't lead his boxing combinations with punches. He leads with his chin every single time. And Imavov, again, his whole entire game is, I can use my volume to move forward. I can counter with power when I'm on the back foot. And if he does get on top on the mat, I think he's the overwhelmingly better grappler out of the between these two. With Buckley, his strikes are still very raw. Again, he can land those crazy 360 spin kicks. But again, that strike was much more of an isolated strike than the story about Joaquin Buckley's game. I think he's going to come into this fight primarily as a boxer. And if he's not able to knock out Imavov in, you know, the first or second round, I do think Nassourdine, again, is the much more technical fighter between these two. And that's why I like him in this matchup. I think he is going to be able to slide in and out of range effectively and probably find the chin of Joaquin Buckley at some point. Because if Kevin Holland, who is a blown up middleweight, Welterweight, sorry, can have enough power to drop a guy like Joaquin Buckley, I do think Imavov, if he is able to land on the chin of Buckley, can probably put him down as well.
To me, I think Imavov wins this fight. It's always the you know, fear of the knockout out of Joaquin Buckley, whether it's for or against. But you look at this matchup, I do like the volume out of Imavov. I don't like the fact that Imavov can get held with his back up against the cage for long periods of his fights, something that Joaquin Buckley can do very well. I prefer the gas tank out of Imavov, but again, if you like Joaquin Buckley in this matchup, you know, his NFTs in 2021 were probably like Hansel. They were so hot right now. They in were. 2022, I haven't heard about NFTs anymore. Are they still a thing?
I don't want to bring up Ian Heinisch again, but every single time I see his Twitter, he's just like, hashtag all these different things.
NFTs, they're still hot.
They're still a thing.
Both of us going with France's Nassourdine Imavov to get the win. Coming up this weekend, let us know in the comments section who you have. Some big-time fights. Another middleweight banger in the co-main event. Whittaker taking on Vettori. Main event, Ciryl Gane taking on Tai Tuivasa. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Another one of France's own looking to get the win. Coming up this weekend, we have the smile killer, Fares Ziem, and he's going to be taking on the former Cage Warrior star, Michael Mad Dog Wusso Figlak. And it's going to be a really interesting fight. This one was announced on August the 16th, so short notice for both guys. And you might be sitting there going, well, boys, I mean, Fight Night Picks, didn't Fares Ziem, wasn't he on UFC roster watch back in the spring? Didn't he get released? Well, he fought out his contract, and then they waited a little bit, tried to ice him out, and then they signed him to come back this weekend.
You're making it sound really nice for Fares Ziem.
I mean, listen, they brought him back. The guy's 2-2 in the UFC. He got finished in impressive fashion his last time out against Terrence McKinney. It was weird. It was one of those ones where it was like that TV show. If you just did a freeze frame in about 4 seconds, and then if you showed the end of the fight, it'd be the, well, you're probably wondering how I ended up here. Terrence McKinney rushes in, Fares Ziem throws a leg kick, McKinney kind of drops, and then they scramble. McKinney ends up on top, and then he ends up getting the submission. For Fares Ziem, his whole UFC career has been just a quandary of weirdness, and I can break it down fight by fight, frame by frame, vote by vote from every judge, and I can pick apart all two of his wins. And then I can look at his losses and I can really kind of just scratch my head. But we're here to talk about Michael Figlak, a guy whose nickname is very interesting because, again, if you're going with Mad Dog, why I waste my time every single friggin' year? I get myself juiced up for this team and then they lose. The San Francisco Giants, they lose.
They've won a lot of World Series in the past 15 years. I don't know if I'd be that fired up, Mad Dog.
That was
I know
an old Mad Dog, quotable. He's on First Take now, which is the weirdest thing ever.
It's like him, Michael Irving, and Stephen A. Smith. The three weirdest people to get into a room together, but hey, I'm kind of here
for it. Fight Night Picks fans are going to learn that I'm about high heat. I'm a big Christopher Mad Dog Wusso fan for the longest time. But for Michael Figlak, I love this guy's game. I mean, I don't want to gush throughout this video.
Gush, Craig.
For Figlak, he very much is a fighter of the fundamentals. You might recognize his brother, who's also a very good fighter. The fact that he has plenty of submission wins. He's a purple belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Comes out of Trojan Free Fighters. He's one of those dual British-Polish type of fighters. But if you do look at the bare bones of his game plan, great boxing combinations. He throws with power. He picks his shots. He goes from the head to the body. He doesn't throw a lot of kicks. He's got legs like tree trunks. They're like Devin Clark-style legs, but boiled down to the lightweight division. Watching Michael Figlak tape was a lot of fun. Obviously, his last win to get him into the UFC over Agi Sardari is a big one because Sardari was the Cage Warriors champion at lightweight. And Figlak looked great in that matchup. But going back and looking at all the tape, obviously he was kind of pining for a fight against Hardwick for the title. Not going to happen. But what did you make of the Figlak rewatch? Because I had a lot of fun going back and watching it.
I got to be completely open, honest, and transparent about this. I'm surprised he's fighting Fares Ziem in his UFC debut. I really thought they'd give Figlak like kind of a fading vet, if you will. Someone who's a little bit more well-known than someone like
Clay Guida.
No, because Clay Guida is sort of on the hotness right now. Like, I don't know who he's fighting, but they just announced a really good Clay Guida fight not that long ago. But with Figlak, along those lines, like, that is the right kind of thinking.
Leonardo Santos.
How sad do you want it to get? That would be a good matchup. But, like, Fariseum's game isn't all that refined in MMA, and that's my big issue with Fariseum. It's been my issue with him his whole entire UFC run. He is a good kickboxer, but he's not that high volume, he's not that high power, and his takedown defense and overall grappling package isn't all that great. So for Ziem, I really felt like he needed more time to kind of refine his game and get it more lined up for MMA, because look at a guy like Gokhan Saki. Gokhan Saki is one of the greatest kickboxers of all time, and I know by the time he came over to MMA, he was quite advanced in his age, and he'd taken a lot of damage, but still, if a guy like that can't just transfer over to the world of MMA and have instant success, someone like Fariseum, who, yes, has more of a record, more of a build-up, but his game is still very much built around, I'm going to try to out-volume you on the feet with my striking, and the fact that we have 4-ounce gloves sort of helps his power a little bit, because I do think that's the big problem with Ziem. People don't respect his punching power, so they can just sort of walk in on a lot of his shots. They're not going to play the pitter-patter game on the outside, and with Figlak and his striking style, I think that is going to eliminate a lot of the kicking game of Ferris Ziem, because like you had mentioned, Figlak isn't somebody who's going to throw his own strikes, or throw his own kicks. You look at his legs and assume he kicks like Leon Edwards, but he does not. He is going to try to get on the inside and try to employ some of his own boxing, and if he is able to get on the inside of the range of Ziem, that's going to eliminate 50% of the offense that Ferris Ziem normally brings into the cage, and if he's not able to get that part of his game going early, if he isn't able to use the leg kick like he did against Terrence McKinney in that very short second like you had mentioned, I don't really know how Ziem can really keep Figlak off of him to then have a lot of success, because I do think he is going to have to try to get his back off the cage, dig under hooks, probably show a wrinkle of his game that he hasn't shown up until this point, and I'm not sure Ferris Ziem's the guy who can go away for a few months, come back, and just become that new fighter.
Well, and I made a mistake, because I said purple belt in jiu-jitsu Figlak. It's actually Ferris Ziem that's a purple belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and I wrote that down because, hey, it's there, but we just don't see it.
Shogun Hua's got a black belt.
He trains out of Lyon in France, out of Climax Fight Academy, a very interestingly named spot. But if I do look at it for Ziem in the UFC, let's break it down frame by frame. He fights Don Madge. Two of the judges, 30-27, 129-28, gets controlled for 9 minutes and 37 seconds. Struggles with the takedown. He goes out there and he fights Terrence McKinney. We already mentioned that fight. Let's pick apart his two wins. He beats Luigi Vendramini, first round, second round, controls the distance. Third round, gets taken down. I had it a 10-8 as a draw in the fight. The judges scored it a majority decision win for Ziem. Two of them didn't think it was enough for a 10-8 in the third. That's fine. Vendramini went ham. His fight against Jamie Mullerkey, all three judges score it 29-28 for Ziem. MMA decisions 15-2 in favor of Mullerkey, who was able to implement the takedown, punish him a little bit on the ground, but on the feet, it was Ziem doing the damage. But he's just struggled in the UFC. And for Figlak, again, we go through this one. His brother Matt Figlak, 7-1 in MMA. The one loss is to Ian Machado Gary. It's not Ian Gary anymore. It's Ian Machado Gary. If you do look at it,
name's Rocco.
Listen, he was expecting Dana White's Contender Series or the UFC off his win over Sardari. And in his own words, he's aiming right for that 50K in this fight. So if we do have a look at the odds, they opened at par. Ziem now plus 165, Figlak minus 200. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, there to you. I accidentally hit the mouse. 916 total votes, 69% Figlak. Large portion have him to win by decision. 31% that have Ziem. Large portion, again, to win by decision. Matt, we set it up in a certain way, and I feel bad about it, because Ferris Ziem could catch him on the way in. But I think Michael Figlak, with his boxing combinations, his ability to go to the head, to the body, and his X factor, he's a very good wrestler as well. We didn't mention that. I think Figlak wins this fight.
I do, too. For Ziem, he just has a weird game at the UFC level, if we're being honest. I do like Figlak, his ability to mix his wrestling in with his boxing, because it's not necessarily one thing you have to worry about. He is going to go to the body with his shots. He's going to keep your hands going from your head to your body to defending takedowns, and that's a lot to think about. So I do like Figlak in this matchup.
Both of us going with the man out of the UK, Michael Figlak, to get the win. Maybe his brother Matt ends up in the UFC as well. The guy from 2013-17 was 10-2 as an amateur, and he's already 8-0 as a pro. One of those losses as an amateur to one Jack Tank Shore, who just had a fight booked. So both of us going with Figlak. Let us know in the comment section who you have. Some big fights on the main card coming up this weekend, including one Robert Whittaker taking on Marvin Vettori. Don't know if you've heard of those guys. Cyril Gane taking on Taito Ivasi. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this week weekend for Dustin Stoyskos. He ended his three-fight introductory UFC losing skid with a win over one Dwight Grant. Got that one done not that long ago, back in July. And this fight was actually announced July 22nd. Dustin Stoyskos beat Dwight Grant July 16th. So a very, very quick turnaround for Stoyskos, looking to replace Makhmud Muradov in welcoming in Abus Magomedov to the UFC. And for Magomedov, his Keith Richards, start me up, I never stop. Well, his never stop stopping UFC tenure. Now that sounds like that Lonely Island movie, The Bomb. But for Magomedov, he was signed to the UFC back in August of 2021. And then everybody got excited, and he hasn't fought
since. Where you been,
Abus? I mean, for Abus Magomedov, he was booked against Gerald Meerschaert in December. He was booked against Aliaskar Pezria back in March of this year. He was booked against Muradov, and now he ends up taking on Dustin Stoyskos. And UFC fans, MMA fans, Fight Night Picks fans, you might know Magomedov because he was a PFL finalist in their original season. He was put on a poster by Bilal Muhammad's teammate, Lewis Taylor, in that fight, got knocked out by a left hook.
That's going to happen, though.
It's going to happen sometimes. But if you look at it for his season overall, he had two first-round finishes. He had a majority draw on the playoffs night, because you fight twice in one night. So majority draw in the two-round fight, in the three-round fight, he was able to get a unanimous decision win to move on. If you look at Abus Magomedov, he hasn't fought very often at all. His last fight was almost 2 years ago against Cezary Kezik over with KSW. And my God, did he look good in that fight. And he put Kezik to sleep with a front choke in that one. So pretty cool stuff from Magomedov. Before that, a big win over with EMC 3 years and 3 months ago. And you might go, hey, I remember that PFL season. Was that like 4 years ago? Yeah, it was. It was 2018. So for Magomedov, hasn't fought very often. You look at the last name and you look at that tweet that Aaron Bronstetter put out back in July, that fighters with Magomedov in their name like 84% of the time in the UFC. I like that. And I really like Abus Magomedov's style, because you might look at his last name and go, well, this guy's a grappler. He won his last fight by submission. This guy's a striker, and it's like watching a K1 artist at the purest form strike in MMA. He really is a lot of fun from either stance. Looks like a Thai fighter. I really do like Magomedov's style, and I think he's a fun fighter. It's just, he hasn't fought in forever, and he doesn't fight very often.
I don't know if he's Rico Verhoeven.
I have no idea what we're going to get out of him this weekend.
And, well, the good news is he's fighting Dustin Stoyskos, so we don't really know what we're getting out of him this weekend either. And that's the weird thing about this fight. The best version of both guys are genuinely talented fighters. And with Abus Magomedov, I do really like his striking style. I think he can go to the legs against Dustin. I think he is going to be able to use his boxing very effectively against Stoyskos, because the thing about Stoyskos' style is that he's really just going to take what you give him, and then if he is more skilled in any one area, that's when he can sort of finish with his own submissions or with some of his movement. But the problem is, on the feet, he's almost like if Christophe Jaco didn't have the volume. Like, it's a lot of the movement, it's some of the single shots, but that's about it. And if Abus Magomedov just doesn't respect the striking power of Dustin Stoyskos, I think he is just going to be able to walk forward and walk forward and walk forward. Because for Stoyskos, up until he fought Dwight Grant, who's near the end of his career, who is like a welterweight moving up to middleweight.
Dwight Grant had just gotten knocked out by Sergey Kondashko like a couple months before that, and then took the fight against Stoyskos up a weight class.
So that's the thing. Like, okay, Dustin, if you had lost that fight, it's definitely over. And this is not a good fight for him whatsoever, taking on a guy making his UFC debut. It really does feel like this is a fight to get Abus Magomedov kind of back in people's mind, because he is the more exciting fighter out of these two. I don't think I'd get much of a disagreement from anybody on that whatsoever. And I don't know how Stoyskos is going to finish this fight if he's not able to immediately get on top and try to get some crazy submission, because Magomedov is a good enough grappler to where he is going to be able to just work out of some positions. He's not going to get trapped in a guillotine and immediately tap out of panic. He's going to try to defend and actually work through some of these positions. And on the feet, I think he's way more heavy-handed. He has really good kicks. Defensively, I do worry about him if he fought, like, I know Uriah Hall's retired, but that's just always my example to go to. A guy who is very patient, who is going to wait for you to open up with your game a little bit and then really make you pay for it. But Dustin Stoyskos isn't that guy at all. He can land some of those single shots. He just doesn't necessarily have the power behind it to really hurt a guy like Magomedov.
Like, if you look at it for Dustin Stoyskos, he can open up his grappling with the striking, trying to land a lot of those power shots. You saw that on the way up. I mean, when he was fighting guys like Jonas Bilstein and knocking him out. If you do look at it for Stoyskos, there is a lot of that there, but you see his grappling is really the complement of his game. And I threw it up there in the gym section, BJJ Globetrotters, because that's where he's training, just kind of getting ready for this fight that is so short notice over in Europe. But if you look at it for Stoicefist, black belt in Lucha Libre, you see that exactly in his style. He's a purple belt in Jiu-Jitsu. That complements his red belt in Tang Sudo, which is a Korean version of karate. But for Stoicefist, it very much is, I'm going to strike until I don't have to strike anymore. Then I'm going to implement my ground game. You look at his last fight against Dwight Grant, he gets down on the volume numbers in the first round. Then he implements his game, round two, round three, wins the decision. For Magomedov, trains at a UFD gym, giant gym over in Dusseldorf in Germany. You recognize a lot of names out there. Obviously, one championship middleweight, Roberto Soldic, has trained out of that gym in the past. I don't know why the fuck he signed over there. They probably threw the fucking bag at him, and rightfully so. And his shirt this weekend was way too fucking tight.
I don't know why you're swearing so much over something that doesn't really matter.
Big Roberto Soldic fan, one championship. Chatri Sityatong, just throwing money around. Everybody gets $50,000 bonuses, but when it comes to this
good matchup, at least someone's paying fighters.
Coming up this weekend, Magomedov, giant favorite, open to -220, -258 as it stands on the live line. For Stoicefist, open +185, +205. I don't know anybody going with like a -300 Abbas Magomedov that hasn't fought since December of 2020. We have a look at the fan vote. I expect everybody to go with Magomedov, Matt. I'm going to say over under 80% Magomedov.
I was thinking 80%. I'll say over.
And it is over. 1,010 total votes. 86% Magomedov. 56% by decision. 31% by submission. For the 14% that have Stoicefist, 77% by decision. He also has that, slam knockout win on Dana White's Contender Series that got him into the UFC over Joe Pyfer, who's all the hotness right now. I have Abbas Magomedov to win this fight coming up this weekend, but there's too many red flags, the inactivity, and so on and so forth for me to just consider it a pop and popcorn fight and just stay away from it, because a guy that hasn't fought in that long as an almost -300 favorite seems a little bit silly. So I do have Magomedov, love the striking, love it in this matchup, but I'm staying away from this one this weekend.
I agree with you that, yes, there are some red flags around this matchup, but they're giving Magomedov a pretty good debut fight, if we're being completely honest. Like, for Dustin, he's not the most heavy-handed of strikers, or he hasn't shown that at the UFC level. He's a good grappler, but he's not like a Rodolfo Vieira or like a Jacare Souza or Andrea Muniz. Like, he's good, but not great in that one area. So I think it's going to be really hard for Dustin to finish Magomedov in this matchup, and for that reason, I do like Magomedov.
Both of us going with Abbas Magomedov, the red flags of the layoff. We'll see how that plays out. Coming up this weekend, let us know in the comments section on these fights who you have, because we got a big time main card coming up with, hey, another middleweight contest in the co-main event. Whitaker taking on Vittori Siddelgon versus Tai Tuivasa in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, this is the people's fight. This is the underground fight of the night. These guys are featherweights knocking on the door of the rankings. We have Bélé, Quebec, Canada's own heir, Charles Jourdain, taking on the prospect. But you've had 23 fights. You got to drop that nickname. It's Nathaniel Wood, the former Cage Warriors champion, looking to get it done at featherweight. And he had 22 pro fights at bantamweight, the whole span of his career. And then the weight cut was too much. So his last fight, he takes on Charles Rosa. He's looking to make it two Charles in a row. 30-26, 30-26, 30-27 against Rosa. They hugged it out. Michael Bisping hated it in that matchup. But Nathaniel Wood looked like a man unchained in that fight. His kicks were great. His boxing combinations were great. He looked like the fighter that we came to love at 135 pounds. Obviously, he had that fight of the night against Casey Kenney before he took a long stretch away, because that was October 2020 before fighting at UFC London here not that long ago. And for Charles Jourdain, his last time out, he took on PFL money man Shane Burgos. If the fans didn't know that one, yeah, Shane Burgos took the bag. And for Jourdain, you go back and watch that fight, and I can talk about the MMA decisions. I mean, some had it for Burgos, some had it for Jourdain. I thought Jourdain did enough in the first round with his boxing. Obviously, Burgos is able to take the back and hold it for about 2.5 minutes of that first round. But the third round, if you just watch the third round, Charles Jourdain completely outboxed Shane Burgos and looked amazing in that one. The second round, Burgos controlled the back for about 4 minutes of it, enough for Michael Bell to give a 10-8 in that one.
If you have someone's back for 4 minutes, it's hard not to give
a 10-8. The first minute, Charles Jourdain completely outboxed him.
Well aware. 80% of the round was spent with another man on his back, though.
Damage means more. But regardless, for Charles Jourdain, I said this at one point in his UFC career, Matt, in one of our videos. I said, is he the best UFC featherweight that's 2-2-1? I'm going to frame it this way. Is he the best UFC featherweight that's 4-4-1 now in his career?
Without a doubt.
It's kind of strange to see Jourdain at this point in his career, 4-4-1, but fighting the level of competition that he has. And this matchup, I think it's a lot of fun. What do you make of this matchup here?
This is the fight that tells us whether or not Nathaniel Wood can fight a featherweight. Because here's the thing. I thought he was going to beat Charles Rosa like everybody else in the world. So do you know what I learned from him beating Charles Rosa? Pretty much nothing, if we're being honest. Like, his volume looked a little bit better because I don't think the weight cut's getting to him as much as it did at 135. And people probably remember, like, the crazy pictures of him when he was getting ready to weigh in at 135. You could see every fiber in this man's body. Well, you could see every vein in this guy's body.
He was supposed to fight at bantamweight earlier on this spring, and then in the 11th hour, the fight was canceled.
Exactly. So the thing about Wood was, he was a great two-round fighter at the bantamweight division, but the weight cut would sort of steal that last 5 minutes from him. I don't think that's going to be a case at 145, but he isn't going to be the biggest guy in this division. Like, some guys move up in weight and they're still big for the next weight division. Think of a guy like Max Holloway. Like, Holloway, if he moved up to 155, would still be a pretty big lightweight. The thing about Wood is, he is going to suffer with some of the height against some of these upper echelon featherweights. Think about guys like Brian Ortega, Yair Rodriguez, Max Holloway. Like, these
Brian Ortega is 2 inches taller than him.
That's what I mean. Like, these guys are all really, really big for the weight class. So I do think that at a certain point, Nathaniel Wood's going to struggle with some of the physicality of some of these guys because he has good punching power, but he's not one of these top-tier punchers. So again, I do think it's going to struggle, or at least his power is going to struggle, up in this weight class against a guy like Charles Jourdain. But he is so technical, and that's always been the thing about Nathaniel Wood. He can work behind a jab. He likes to throw a straight right behind it. If you're not really good with your own boxing, if you don't move well on the feet, which he throws really good leg kicks to help cut down his opponent's movement, he is going to be one of those sniper kind of fighters. Even against Charles Rosa, he was able to cut down on the leg, make him a sitting duck, really box him up with some of his combinations. And then when the fight did hit the mat, Nathaniel Wood's not some scrub. I know we don't normally talk about his grappling, just because it's not really the part of his game that's on showcase all that often. But when he's in top control, he has really good ground and pound, really nice elbows too from the clinch and on the ground. I just don't know how this fight isn't going to be amazing. Like, this is one of those fights where I don't care who wins, I don't care who loses, I don't care when it gets stopped. Like, it's just going to be an awesome fight between two really good fighters in the weight class.
I think it's
going
to be really, really close. And I thought for Nathaniel Wood, taking on Charles Rosa, a guy who has experience at 145 and 155, size-wise, they matched up really, really well in that one.
But Rosa's not the biggest guy in the weight class at all. Like, when Rosa fought Shane Burgos, he looked small compared to him. When he fought Yair, he looked small compared to him.
Well, and I mean, Shane Burgos looked a weight class bigger than Charles Jourdain. In that matchup, like, Burgos, maybe it was the camera angle, he looked huge, but in that matchup, it was a bit of a surprise that Burgos decided, I'm not going to box with Jourdain, I'm going to work in my takedowns and my wrestling and have a lot of success with it. And for Jourdain, we saw from the orthodox stance, his boxing was so fast, so crisp, with a lot of power. Obviously, you know him from Southpaw. He's that leveled up Gabriel Benitez that we always wanted. His kicks to all three levels from Southpaw are great. And when he switches over to orthodox, the boxing is there. I'm eager to see how Nathaniel Wood, because he is a big leg kicker, how that factors into his game. Because if it's orthodox versus southpaw, that opens up the body kick for Charles Jourdain, where it could be interesting to see how he decides to target the lead leg of Jourdain to then open up the orthodox boxing out of Jourdain. But when I do look at this matchup, very, very well-rounded, very, very close fight. Each guy skill for skill matches up very well. And I can see a scene where Nathaniel Wood pushes a pace, Jourdain backing up, he holds that really high guard, and then he opens up with some of his striking, or Jourdain is able to push a bit of a pace, throw his kicks, open up that longer range to where he can find success. So we do look at this matchup, we do look at the odds. Jourdain open a minus 200 favorite. He's a minus 140 right now. For Nathaniel Wood, open plus 170, plus 116. We have a look at the Tapology votes. I would be surprised if they're not very close. I'm going to say over under 60% Charles Jourdain.
I think they'll be over.
You think they're going to be over? They're way over. 1,020 total votes, 73% Jourdain, 47% by decision, 43% by knockout. For the 27% that have Nathaniel Wood, 77% by decision. How do you see this fight playing out?
It's going to be interesting. Again, I think Nathaniel Wood's going to be the steadier fighter in this matchup. I think he's going to use the jab a lot. I do think he's going to stick to his kicks. The thing about Charles Jourdain is his peaks are going to be higher, but his valleys are going to be a lot lower too. And that's the thing that I have a really hard time predicting in this fight. Think about a third round Jourdain against Shane Burgos. Now think third round Jourdain against Julian Arosa. Like, it really depends on how fast is he going to burn early on in the fight. If he can fight at his own pace, then he will be around in that third round. And I do think his power shots will eventually get to Nathaniel Wood because he is the bigger guy. He is going to be whipping out heavier kicks. But there's a little part of me that thinks that the jab and the leg kicks of Nathaniel Wood can work to his benefit. I'm going to pick Charles Jourdain ever so slightly in this matchup because, again, I do think that as this fight goes on, if he is dedicated to the leg kick and the body kick, it's at least going to level off these guys' cardio to make them similar versions of each other. And if it is one of those give one to take one type of fights, I do think Jourdain has the heavier hands in this matchup. So I'm ever so slightly picking Charles Jourdain, but you could definitely make a compelling argument either way.
Yeah, I mean, this fight kind of thrown together on short notice, both guys having competed so recently with Wood. The Rosa fight was just back in July for Jourdain, the fight against, oh boy, Shane Burgos, that was back in July. And for Jourdain, that is the truth. The third rounds can be completely different. The fight against Julian Arosa, the fight against Andre Ewell, Jourdain was really pouring it on, exactly, just like he did in the Burgos matchup. So the lasting image in your head is, well, geez, I thought Jourdain beat Shane Burgos. I go back and watch that third round. How did he not beat him? And for Nathaniel Wood, you might forget about it. I mean, the loss to Casey Kenny was a fight of the night. Great volume. The loss to John Dodson was the one that kind of derailed a little bit of the hype, but wins over Teco Quinones, who we talk about all the time on the channel. John Castaneda, that's a win that really ages well, especially when you pair it up with this one.
And that's the weird thing about Nathaniel Wood. If you do match him up with someone who's outside, and I know this is going to sound oddly specific, but outside of like the top 17, top 18, he's going to blow the doors off them. Like, he's that much more technical than the majority of unranked fighters in the weight class. But that's the thing. When you do get up, especially in the featherweight division, into that like borderline ranking 17, 16, 15, 14, like those guys seem to be a world ahead of some of the other fighters. So that's why this fight is so important for Nathaniel Wood, because Jourdain is sort of the gatekeeper to the rankings right now. So if you are able to beat him, you're as legit as anybody in the division. But if you're not able to beat Jourdain, it does feel like the rankings are even that much further away from Wood. So this is such a fun fight.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Nathaniel Wood in the matchup. I love the volume on the feet. Both guys have incredible volume. I just love the steadiness of Wood to continue where it's a lot of peaks and valleys with Charles Jourdain. But I absolutely love the matchup. I can't wait for it. We're split on the pick. It should be an amazing one. I really want to hear from the folks out there in the comment section on this one. You guys come with some of the best insight and knowledge in the sport down there in the comment section. So fill it up. I can't wait for the fights coming up this weekend. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend. Lightweight's looking to try and crack the rankings once more. We have Nasrat Haqparast, a Fight Night Picks fan favorite fighter representing Afghanistan and Germany, taking on the bull John McDessie, formerly of Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, the Maritime Zone. Let's get up. Let's get excited. And for John McDessie, the guy's 4-1 in his last five fights. Now, for John McDessie, this is the other thing. If you look at those five fights, he had one fight in 2017, one in 2018, one in 2019, one in 2020, one in 2021. Injuries have been a big factor into it. Before his fight against Ignacio Bahamondes, he had switched gyms again because McDessie, TriStar guy. Then he was a Rufus Sport guy. Then he had the injury. He went down to the MMA lab. I listened to that interview from James Lynch that soured my memory. But McDessie was like, yeah, I just had a major ACL injury and surgery, so I don't know about this fight. And then he goes out and fights Ignacio Bahamondes. And it says split decision on his record. He poured the fucking pressure on Ignacio Bahamondes. Hurt him up bad. I mean, for Bahamondes, he did weigh in at 156.75 pounds for that fight. But McDessie looked amazing his last time out. And that fight was a year and many months ago. And I threw it up there, and I will throw the tweet up there right now. There was a Twitter profile at MMA Injury. It's Kevin Nicholson. Hamstring avulsion injury and surgery. So that's the injury this time out for John McDessie. This fight was actually originally scheduled for February of this year, but both guys out due to some injuries. For Nasrat Haqparast, left hand injury after his fight against Bobby Green. Had to get surgery on that one. But I said this about Charles Jourdain earlier on in the show, and I'm going to say it about Nasrat Haqparast as well. When the guy came into the UFC, it was 4-1. He looked amazing. He was knocking everybody down in his fights, down or out. He's 5-4 in the UFC. Did you ever see that for Nazareth Hackbrass?
No, and I'm really glad that you handed this off to me in this way, because here's the thing. Nazareth Hackbrass is almost about to become the Dante Exum of, like, my mind in the UFC. I thought old Dante Exum was going to be sick. Thought he was going to win MVPs, all NBAs. Like, I thought Dante Exum was the man. Dante Exum's playing in, like, the G League somewhere in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and nobody knows where he is. Nazareth Hackbrass has been on a weird run, though, and to his credit, he has taken on a very high level of competition, so it's not like he is just losing to scrubs who are just entering the UFC or anything like that, but he did have a very high ceiling projected for him at one time. He made his UFC debut against a former Bellator champion in Marcin Held.
Knocked him down in that fight.
Exactly. Hurt him. Got out grappled for the large part in that matchup, but still made a really good account of himself, especially early on in his career. But this is a weird fight against John McDessie, because, like, John McDessie at one point, let me get this straight. Like, Cowboy Cerrone knocked him out and then fought for a title. They didn't fight a title eliminator, but still, Cowboy had won 7 straight fights and then knocked out John McDessie with a head kick. So, McDessie at one point was considered a real player in this division. A lot of people probably remember him for that knockout loss to Lando Venata, too. Lando hit him with one of the greatest spinning back kicks
but
of all time.
Do they remember his fight of the night, which was an absolute barn burner against Ross Pearson?
They do not. Now, that was a really fun fight, too. But that's the thing about John McDessie. He's a very boxing-heavy fighter who does throw a lot of leg kicks. He holds his stance in a very sort of stiff way, even though I wouldn't say he's a stiff fighter whatsoever, because he does like to spam a lot of spinning back fist a la like Marab Dvalishvili, especially earlier on in his career. But for McDessie, the technique does land quite a bit. It's just one of those things where it's kind of a bad thing if it lands early in a fight, you know? Because if it lands early, he's going to try to go back to that well over and over again. And those are the type of techniques that Nazareth Hackbrass and his boxing style can definitely counter and land his own power shots off of. I just feel like Hackbrass is sort of like 6 years ago's John McDessie. He still has some of the promise. He still has a lot of the skills. We just don't really know where he falls in this lightweight division at this point. And the other thing, too, about Hackbrass is, has he really gotten that much better since he came into the UFC? Like, for the most part, he's kind of the same guy that he was when he first showed up.
Both of these guys have bounced around from gyms, and I said that with McDessie. He was a tri-star. He was a Rufus sport. He went to the MMA lab. He looked amazing against Bahamundas, and then he switched it up right after that and went to Ultimate Combat Fitness with Javier Torres. Like, it was... So he's been at Ultimate Combat Fitness for what seems like a year or more now down in the States. For Hackbrass, same thing. He came out of Germany. Then he was a TriStar. Then he was at Kings. He's been all over the place. And if you do look at it for Hackbrass, he's a southpaw that throws a lot of volume. You'd think that would have worked great in his last fight against Bobby Green. How bad was his hand before that fight going into it? Obviously ended up getting surgery. Lost that fight. All three judges scored at 30-27. Got out volumed 188-76. And of Hackbrass' 76 strikes that landed, he threw at a 39% clip. Like, it wasn't the Hackbrass we know. In his fight against Dan Hooker, it was thrown together on super short notice. Like, visas were an issue. His mom had just passed away. And he got completely out-wrestled by Dan Hooker.
But that's the thing, like, Bobby Green and Dan Hooker would probably both stop John McDessie. So, like, losing to guys like that doesn't mean that you can't then turn around and beat the bull, John McDessie.
The bull, John McDessie. Matt, we have a look at the odds in this one. Hackbrass, open to -200 favorite, -225 right now in the two-fight losing streak. The man who's 4-1 in his last 5 fights, McDessie, open to +170. He's now at a +180. He hit as an underdog of about that magnitude against Bahamundes in his last fight. That fight was about a year and 4 months ago. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you. Ton of Fight Night Picks fans are Hackbrass fans. Ton of fans are Hackbrass fans. I'm going to say over under 80% Hackbrass.
Whether he's the fan favorite or not, they just should be around 80%, just skill-wise, I believe.
You gonna say over-under?
I'll say over.
I'm gonna say over? Slightly over. 1,103 total votes, 82% Hackbrass, 77% by decision, 15% by knockout for the 18% that have McDessie, 78% by decision. Would it surprise me if John McDessie hit as an underdog like this against Nazareth Hackbrass? Well, fuck, it surprised me when he did it against Ignacio Bahamundes. So it wouldn't necessarily surprise me. He throws good volume. He throws good leg kicks. He could slow down some of the advances of Hackbrass. I think the southpaw stance, the power, and the boxing combinations of Hackbrass are enough to get the win. So I'm going with Hackbrass in this one. But I think it's a good skill check for both guys.
It definitely is. If John McDessie loses this, it'll be hard to see him come back and try to keep on going at 37 years of age. I know he's looked good as of late, but still.
John McDessie's been in the UFC since 2010.
Which is an insane stat to think about. But Hackbrass, again, he's the much more technical guy, especially from the outside. And I don't think McDessie can win a decision in this fight. And that's the important thing. Hackbrass does sort of charge charge in a lot with some of his combinations. He won't really set them up with the jab always. He normally does, but sometimes he'll kind of get a little reckless, get frustrated, and then charge in. If he charges into a strike from John McDessie, maybe he could get dropped and finished that way. But I do still like the volume and the hand speed of Hackpress to be able to pick up a decision win.
Both of us going with the much younger man and Nasrat Hackpress to get the win. Let us know in the comments section if we shouldn't go against our fellow Canadian in this matchup and who you have. We have some big fights on this main card. A middleweight top contenders fight between Robert Whittaker and Marvin Vettori. A heavyweight top contenders fight between Cyril Gane and Tai Tuivasa. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, unranked middleweights that are probably like your average guy listening to Eminem before a pickup basketball game. We have Alessio Di Chirico taking on Roman Kopylov, and I say that because these guys are so unranked, it's not even funny. And then in the co-main event, you have the number one ranked middleweight, Robert Whittaker, taking on the number two ranked Marvin Vettori. Why in the hell are these guys in this spot on the main card? I don't know.
It's kind of like watching a G League game and then you're going to turn on the NBA Finals. I think they just want to show you the showcase between the two.
It's like watching Gerald Green and his brother in the Big Three and then watching like LeBron James and Anthony Davis.
Gerald Green was one of those exciting in-game dunkers of all time. I'm not going to stand here and listen to any slander.
I say all of this because for Alessio Di Chirico, he's 1-4 in his last five fights. He's 4-6 in the UFC and he's taking on the former AMC Fight Nights Global middleweight champ Roman Kopylov, whose last win was December of 2018. He got out-grappled and subbed by Glory kickboxer Carl Robertson. And his last time out against Albert Duraev, 130-27, 229-27s against Albert Duraev, where he did drop him in the second round. He threw like a right cross that dropped him. And then he also had that moment in that fight in, what, the third round where he looked like Luke Rockhold, hands on his knees, completely tired. And then as Duraev walks in, he hits him. And then he felt pretty good about himself. From Roman Kopylov, this guy looked amazing with Fight Nights Global. I can't stress that enough. I went back and watched a lot of that tape to get ready for this matchup because you got to see what the guy looks like at his peak to figure out what he could look like in a matchup against Di Chirico. Kopylov would throw with great volume, picking his power shots, tricky southpaw to figure out. He would drop guys. He would mix in all different shots from head to the body. I know I'm selling you a painting like a Mona Lisa you to only get like a Monet that was printed on like, you know, black and white ink by some guy named Jim at like a copy spot. But for Roman Kopylov, we really did have a very, very good prospect that was setting himself up for great aspirations in the UFC. It's just he didn't look good against Carl Robertson, took a lot of time off, fought the former M1 Global double champ, welterweight, middleweight, Albert Duraev, busted up that big eye that ended up getting him finished in his last time out against Joaquin Buckley. But for Roman Kopylov, he just hasn't been able. He's had good takedown defense, but it's been a flurry and, you know, a big amount of volume that's finally been able to get him down to the mat where he hasn't been able to get back up. For Alessio Di Chirico in the UFC, when the going's good, he's knocking out Joaquin Buckley and looking amazing. When the going's bad, he's getting knocked out by Abdulrazak Alhassan. He's losing decisions that are tight. He's beating Julian Marquez in really close fights. Matt, what the hell is the best version of Alessio Di Chirico? A well-rounded guy that can do it all?
A guy who's going to clinch you a lot. And that's what people want to bring up. They're like, oh, remember the head kick against Numancia? I do. But also, I remember the 17 minutes in every 15-minute fight where he just spends holding his opponent up against the cage. Because the thing about Di Chirico is he is a good striker. He does have decent offensive wrestling. He's got a good kicking game like he was able to show against Joaquin Buckley. But the problem is he doesn't have a lot of confidence in his own striking ability. When guys rush forward on him, he's looking for the clinch a lot to sort of smother any separation that they do have, and he is really happy to just try to get not even like ground control time, because ground control time is normally dominant. You're on top, you can hammer away with ground and pound. There are a lot of 50-50 clinches into Chirico's game, and he is good at sort of mapping his way through them. I compare him a little bit to what the modern day Holly Holm does. Like Holly Holm, we all know for the head kicks. But, like, when was the last time Holly Holm landed a head kick? It was a long time ago in Singapore against the lady who doesn't even fight anymore in the UFC. So, yeah. Fucking bitch. So, but for Di Chirico, He does employ good striking defense, and I know he has been finished before, but that is the one good part about his game. He's kind of basic with his own boxing, but he can either keep his opponent's hands up defending his own shots or defending clinches and kind of takedown attempts. I think Khabibov is the much more dangerous guy, especially at range in this matchup, because the thing about Dakiriko is he can sort of get stopped in that first gear in neutral to where he never opens up with his own offense. And if that's the version that we do get this weekend, Khabibov should be able to go in there, land a lot of combinations. He's a much more heavy-handed fighter in this matchup, and I could see him really being able to damage Dakiriko quite a bit. But on the flip side, Khabibov could throw strikes effectively for 4 minutes, maybe even, you know, the totality of the first round, and then Dakiriko clinches him, gets a lot of control time, kind of weathers the early storm, and then just looks good as this fight goes late. Again, Dakiriko's not somebody who's going to build as the fight goes on, don't get it twisted, but he's going to be effective defensively, and boy do I hate that that's the good thing that I can do talking about this fighter, but that's really what I look at when I think about a guy like Dakiriko. It is odd that they are putting him in the third fight in the main card. I don't know if they think this matchup's like a big, you know, France seller, if you will, similar to what Kamaru Usman and Leon Edwards did for the Utah crowd. But this is a strange matchup so high up on the card.
Let's give the people what they want. Alessio Dakiriko and Roman Khabibov. You look at it for Dakiriko, 2014 IMMAF light heavyweight champ. The good experience there. For Roman Khabibov, doing a deep dive on his Instagram, he's been training with a lot of guys over in that country over there. And one of them is Armin Petrosian. So pretty darn good kickboxer there. He's got a combat sambo background. He was a Russian and European champ. He's also a hand-to-hand combat champion as well. And he used to fight behind a good jab. He used to go into the later rounds. He's got some fourth round finishes when he was a champion over with Fight Nights Global, AMC promotion. So we have a look at the odds here. Basically at par. They open at par. Dakiriko, slight favorite, minus 118. Khabibov minus 104. We have a look at the fan vote, Matt. I know Dakiriko is 1-4 in his last five, but I'm going to hazard a guess the fans are going to go with him. So I'm going to say over under 70% Dakiriko.
I think Khabibov would be the favorite.
I think Khabibov's the favorite. It's close. 1,077 total votes. 53% Dakiriko, 76% by decision, 15% by knockout. For the 47% that have Khabibov, 59% by decision, 31% by knockout. Do you think the steadier, more defensively sound fighter Dakiriko wins this matchup this weekend?
Probably, but I'm not picking him. I think Khabibov has the much higher potential to finish this fight. And honestly, that's what I feel the best in. Like, if it goes to decision, it's a coin flip. Either guy could win. It's going to be damage over control. But if we admit that it's going to be a coin flip for a decision, if it ends inside the decision, well, Khabibov's definitely going to be the one who's going to get the finish. So for those reasons, I just think he has more opportunities to win. But like, neither fighter is going to win and then become a ranked contender and then go on to like main event shows.
We haven't seen it since 2018 when Roman Khabibov was on a great run. For Alessio Dakiriko, steady fighter, he could ultimately end up with the win. I actually have Roman Khabibov in this matchup. I love the boxing combinations. I love him in open space. We haven't seen it in the UFC yet. And for Dakiriko, this is one of those ones that somebody goes, oh, geez, I like Khabibov as a slight underdog. I'm going to throw him on the card. Stay away from it. These guys haven't won anything in a meaningful amount of time. Obviously, Dakiriko has more recently with that win over Joaquin Buckley, but it's almost more of an anomaly from the losing. So make a pick and stay away from this one at your own right. Both of us going with Roman Khabibov to get the win. Never thought I'd ever say that on Fight Night Picks. We have two giant fights up ahead of this one. Whitaker Vettori and Gon versus Tuivasa. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, a top contenders fight at middleweight. We have the number one ranked Robert Whittaker, the former champion, the Reaper, taking on the Italian dream, Marvin Vettori, your second ranked middleweight. A couple of guys with squeaky clean records of late and their last respective losses to Israel Adesanya for the belt. This is each man's respective first three-round fight since 2020. I have no idea why this isn't a five-round fight coming up this weekend, Matt. It makes no sense. These two guys are workhorses. They get it done. They really do make the most of those five rounds. And for Whitaker, his last three-round fight was against Jared Cannonier, where he broke Cannonier's arm very quickly with a leg kick. For Marvin Vettori, his last three-round fight,
broke his arm with a leg kick. Broke his arm with a head kick.
Head kick, and he went to block it with his arm. My apologies. For Vettori, his last three-round fight was against old foe Carl Robertson. And he might go, well, yeah, Robertson's way worse than Jared Cannonier, and I agree with you. But that was a big-time rivalry fight. Robertson couldn't make the weight. They argued in hotel lobbies. And then in that one, Robertson decided, I'm just going to forget everything that I'm good at and go for just everything. He threw the kitchen sink at him. Vettori ended up finishing him in the first round. I love this matchup stylistically, Matt, because I think both guys are going to meet and we're going to get a really, really good contest out of this. I think the fans over in Paris at the Accor Arena are in for a treat. What do you make of this matchup coming up this weekend?
These guys are meeting at a really weird stage of their career because for Martin Vettori, he beat a lot of guys he should have beat on his way to a title run. But the weird thing was, I would argue Vettori looked way better against Adesanya than Robert Whittaker did. And I know there's this weird storyline out there where people are like, hey, Robert Whittaker looked good in the second fight. I don't agree with that whatsoever. And I might get some flack because, like, there were genuinely people who thought Whittaker won that second fight against Adesanya. I didn't think it was close at all. He got dropped early. He wasn't really able to land much offense throughout the fight. Adesanya was always able to just keep him on the end of his jab, really stay out of range of a lot of the power shots of Whittaker. Whittaker landed a couple good strikes, but it's not like he fought him like Kelvin Gastelum did, where Adesanya was on like the brink of defeat. And for Vettori, they fight in very different manners, of course, but still, Vettori really never got hit by any big power shots. He used a lot of clinch control, wasn't able to get a lot of his own striking off, but it's not like Marvin Vettori got dropped 6 times against Adesanya. And the first time around, they fought to a split decision, so like, it's not like there's that big of a separation between the two of them. The weird thing, though, about Vettori is, who are his best wins? They're Jack Hermanson, Kevin Holland, like, they're guys who, let's be honest, again, Marvin Vettori was well expected to win in the first place, whereas for Robert Whittaker, he's fought Yoel Romero, Darren Till, like, if anything, he's sort of on the come down from his championship reign, and Marvin Vettori is still very much active in the discussion for the next title shot, or even maybe getting a third fight against Adesanya, which is kind of wild to think about now, but still, if Vettori beats the number one ranked fighter in the world, maybe you do him versus Costa number two at 185, which was supposed to happen the last time out. It would be a really fun fight, but still, for Vettori, that last fight against Costa it does give me some confidence going into this one against Whittaker, because Vettori was able to deal with a lot of the power shots of Paulo Costa, and I don't think Costa's as technically refined as Robert Whittaker is. Whittaker moves a lot better on his feet, he's got a lot better of a bounce to him, but they both strike in sort of a similar manner. They like to mix their kicks in with their punches. And the fact that Vettori was able to eat some of those big power shots from Costa makes me think that he's going to be able to eat a lot of the power shots from Whittaker in this matchup too. And if Vettori is able to really lean on Whittaker, make him feel the physicality, you have to remember, Robert Whittaker used to fight at 170. And I know he's bulked up to the 185 pound weight class a lot. He is a big middleweight, I would say. Marvin Vettori would have to cut, both of his legs off to make 170? Like, there's no way on planet Earth that Marvin Vettori could ever make that weight class. I know we're talking about a different Robert Whittaker, but still, I do expect Vettori to have some sort of physicality edge over Robert Whittaker in this matchup. And I hate that I'm about to say this, because I think the best version of this is easily fight of the night. If Vettori wants to win, I think he's just going to hold Robert Whittaker up against the cage for, like, 13 minutes. And that's not a sexy path to victory. That's not something that's going to get you a title shot. Look at Mirab Dvalishvili versus Jose Aldo. Like, if Rob looked good in that fight, and he got a win, so, you know, what am I to say, but still, he got a win in probably the most boring way you can possibly get one, where, look at what happened a week earlier, Marlon Vera knocked out Dominic Cruz with a head kick. Those guys were considered kind of equals going into the previous matchups. I think a lot more people are higher on Marlon Vera right now than they are on Merab, and I think this might be a similar fight to that, where Vettori might eke out a decision win with a lot of clinch control and takedowns, but it might not be good enough for him to really get a title shot over a guy like Paulo Costa, and that's why I could see them having a rematch in the future.
When you look at it for Marvin Vettori's last time out against Paulo Costa, first round Costa, second round Vettori, third round Vettori, fourth round Vettori, fifth round Costa, which is kind of a surprise to a lot of people. It was a very, very good fight. And when you look at it for Vettori, again, the loss to Israel Adesanya, he couldn't do a lot with the clinch. He couldn't really get the takedowns or work them into that fight. He wasn't able to get the win. When you look at it for Robert Whittaker, it is that combination that he goes to the well with in just about all of his fights him a ton of success. He can mix in a lot of shots, but I'm sure the big counter that you're going to get and the big thing out of our commentary, and we'll throw it on over to the YouTube community tab in just a second, is the fact that if Yoel Romero couldn't mix in his wrestling against Robert Whittaker, what makes you think that Marvin Vettori is going to have any success with it?
I don't. That's the other side of this whole thing. Robert Whittaker has some of the best takedown defense of all time. Now, that was an ACL surgery ago, their first fight, but you also have to remember, he fought for 20 minutes against Yoel Romero with a jacked up ACL that got stomped in the first round of their first fight, and he was still able to make it through that and have really good takedown defense. The difference is, Robert Whittaker's 31 years old, and people remember him as being one of the younger champions when he did secure the belt. He's 75 in MMA years, though, and I think that's something we all have to come to terms with at a certain point. Like, we've seen Whittaker get dropped by multiple fighters. He got knocked out by Wonderboy at 170. Of course, people are going to remember that. He got dropped by Yoel multiple times. He's been dropped by Adesanya multiple times.
Darren Till,
exactly. Like, at a certain point, I do worry about the durability of Robert Whittaker running out. Now, I think he's so much better at striking than Marvin Vettori in the open cage, it's not even funny. And that's really the key for Vettori in this matchup. I know I sound very pro-Vettori, so I guess I'll switch it around. Vettori has to get this fight up against the cage to have any success. He has good boxing, and it's been improving a lot as of late, but he doesn't throw many kicks. The ones that he do throw are very labored. He really has to load up on them. And the problem is, Robert Whittaker moves extremely well. So if you don't go for a lot of takedowns, if you don't throw a lot of leg kicks, he's going to be able to bounce around the cage and really have nothing to worry about coming back from Marvin Vettori if he can't get him up against the cage. Because in open space, Robert Whittaker has too good of a jab, too good of a right hand. He loves that head kick combination. But this is the other thing that we have to talk about. Robert Whittaker hasn't had a knockout in the UFC since 2017. He knocked out Derek Brunson. He knocked out Jacare. He has not had a stoppage victory since 5 years ago now. I don't think Robert Whittaker is a pillow-fisted fighter by any means. I'm just saying, Marvin Vettori has shown nothing but an exceptional chin throughout his UFC tenure, so I find it hard to believe that even though Robert Whittaker is the more technical striker, is the better striker, he's going to be able to go in there and just head kick Marvin Vettori and win.
No, and I mean, for Marvin Vettori, you look at that. Decent boxing combinations to bridge the gap, to get the clinch, to get the takedown, great top pressure, and he can keep that mindset and that pace for five rounds, let alone three. And when you look at it for Vettori, he is the type of guy, if he throws a kick, there's a big reset. So on the half beat, if Whittaker can hit on those spots, that's exactly
and he's got wicked timing.
He will find his success. So we'll throw it on over to the community tab. We threw this one out there 4 hours ago. 583 votes. Co-main event UFC Paris. Can't miss fight at welterweight. Who gets the win? 82% going with Robert Whittaker. Air Dog saying, I don't see why Marvin is such a big underdog in this one. I think this should be a close fight. Phantom saying, I don't think Vettori has anything for him. He can't take him down. He's not really going to outpace him. And I also see him getting outstruck all night. Vettori is very tough, so I don't see him getting finished, but I do see him getting schooled, in my opinion. Bo says, I'm so confident in Whittaker that he'll probably lose. And Bill says, Whittaker has only lost to one guy, and it ain't Marvin Vettori. And my retort was, five guys, goodness, he lost to 10, a guy whose record's now 10-13-2, Hoon Kim at one point. So Whittaker does have losses, but of late, in the last five fights especially, the only two losses, the Adesanya finish loss at home, where he had that K-San walkout, where you could have cried, like it was really emotional at Marvel Stadium. And then his last fight was to Adesanya, where it kind of seemed like, hey, got to pick up the pieces, don't know what's next, but of course it's a fight against the second-ranked guy in Vettori. So the odds here, Whittaker open minus 225, minus 242 right now, Vettori open a plus 188, he's a plus 193, what's the pick?
I have a really hard time with this fight, because I think if Marvin Vettori can make it boring, can use his clinch work, can go to the takedown, he can have a lot of success. The problem is, Robert Whittaker does move exceptionally well on his feet, so I do think it's going to be difficult for Vettori to really corner him in the cage and try to get a hold of him. So I was thinking I'd be picking Marvin Vettori, if I'm being completely honest, but the more I've thought about it, I do think Robert Whittaker can do enough on the in-betweens from some of the takedown attempts of Marvin Vettori to where he's going to be able to damage him, because that's the thing about Vettori. Even though he does have great cardio, even though he does have an exceptional chin, he gets stunned about once a fight, and it does make you kind of nervous. Like, even against Jack Hermanson, Hermanson was landing some really nice right hands by the end of that fight. Kevin Holland, same thing. He was starting to get to Vettori. And against Paulo Costa, I don't know how neither one of those guys got knocked down in that fight, because they were both landing some clean power shots. I just think that since Vettori does leave some openings with his defense, Robert Whittaker should be able to take advantage of them. But if Vittori's ever going to beat Robert Whittaker, like storyline of their career wise, it's definitely right now. It's Vettori. He's only suffered the one loss to the champion. With Whittaker, he's been in a lot of tough fights. He's been near the top of the division for a long time. Like, you can kind of see how the storyline's starting to unravel, but I am going to ever so slightly pick Robert Whittaker in what I hope is a fight of the night quality fight in our co-main event.
Love those odds on Marvin Vettori, and you talk about it. Great fight against Paulo Costa, pushing the pace, throwing with power, able to land. And if you do factor that in, I mean, the fights where he's starting to kind of get chipped away at, we're talking round four, round five.
Robert Whittaker also has all-time great cardio, so I just don't think it's going to matter those two last rounds, no matter what.
No, and again, Whittaker striking on the hot beat, he's got a great opportunity in this fight, so it should be a great one. I have Marvin Vettori as the underdog in this matchup. I think he's going to push the pace. I think he's going to make it ugly, maybe a little bit boring, a la Marab. So I do actually have the Italian Dream as another one of my underdog picks on this card. We're split on this one, but it should be a great fight. When you have the first round ranked and second ranked fighter in a division, you should end up with something great unless somebody breaks their leg or kicks each other in the cup or something crazy at the start.
Okay, but let's not put that mojo on him.
We'll forget about all of that. It should be a great one. Continue to fill up that comment section on this fight because it should be an all-timer in the co-main event and in the main event. Tai Tuivasa just keeps winning.
He does.
And Cyril Gane lost his last fight and got out-wrestled by Francis Ngannou in an all-time mind F. So it should be a great one in that main event. I can't wait for it. Make sure you check it out. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend in the main event of UFC Paris from the Accor Arena in France, we have the number one ranked former interim champ Cyril Bongamangane taking on Bam Bam Tai Tuivasa, your third ranked heavyweight. For Tuivasa, a little bit of a rocky road. Seemed like he was cut a few years ago. He's won five big fights in a row. And for Cyril Gane, his O was taken his last time out against Francis Ngannou in a bid to unify the belts. Francis came out with knee sleeves on and became a wrestler. And it was the weirdest fight I've ever seen in my entire life. And Cyril Gane looked like he had no answer for it. Coach Fernan Lopez was completely stumped and confused. It was one of the biggest mind Fs of a fight that I've ever seen in my life. Whereas for Tuivasa, he's refined those tools. He's become a more technical striker, adding power in. His last time out against Derek Lewis, he looked amazing. His fight against Stefan Struve, he knocked him out, jumped on the cage. And as he jumped, well, his heel kicked Stefan Struve again and knocked him out a second time after the fight was over. Tuivasa has looked amazing. Cyril Gane has looked amazing. Again, a home type of fight for Cyril Gane. MMA was legalized in France back in 2020, and this is the UFC's first fight card in France, so it should be a great contest. But for Tuivasa, mixing things up, and of course, we know his brother-in-law is Tyson Pedro, a guy who's won two big fights by finish his last two times out. They've been training together. He's really put things together, not just in Australia, but with his time in Dubai, and he's mixed up his fight camps there. Looks like he spent some time there for this one as well. Just what have you made of the progression from Tai Tuivasa from kind of like a knock him down, drag him out? Like, I wouldn't even say like 15 to 10. I'd say like 25 to 10 type of fighter to now a guy who's ranked third. I never thought we'd get this out of Tai Tuivasa.
He's still kind of the same. Like, Tai Tuivasa's fighting style is like betting on a roulette wheel. You've got a 50% chance to win and a 50% chance to lose. Like, if he lands the power shot...
Roulette's not 50-50.
I know, there's one that's a different one, Craig. Just hear me out. But for Tai Tuivasa, that's basically what it is. Like, he's going to land that massive hook, or he's not going to land that massive hook and get outskilled. The more interesting half of this fight is Cyril Gane, I believe. Because, like you said, kind of got mind-fucked his last time out there against Francis Ngannou. Francis showed up with a torn ACL and wrestled like he was Daniel Cormier. Not a sentence I ever thought I would say. So Cyril Gane in his career, he's at the point of the Manti Te'o documentary where he gets that picture and she's like, I'm not really dead, Manti. And he's like, whoa, I'm supposed to win the Heisman, but Johnny Manziel got it. Like, this is a weird part of Cyril Gane's career because... if he was going to have any success against Francis, yes, he's a good kickboxer, yes, he's technical, but, like, you'd assume he'd go for one offensive takedown in that matchup against a guy who was wrapped up like Judo Dan Kelly. But no, on the flip side, Francis Ngannou did kind of expose Cyril Gane as not being a great defensive grappler. And that's the thing about Gane. He's not a trained grappler as much as a learned grappler later on in life. He is very physically strong. He does have some good technique, but he's not somebody who can sweep you off of his back and then end up in a top position. I would even say, and I know this isn't a great example right now because he just blew his knee out against Curtis Blaze, but like Tom Aspinall's the type of fighter who, with his jiu-jitsu background, I'm comfortable if he's on the bottom against some fighters because he'll be able to work his way out of that position. Gane was not able to show that ability against Francis Ngannou, a man who has no wrestling background whatsoever. He's just really fast learner, I guess. But that did leave me with a bit of a sour taste in my mouth. And I do believe that Cyril Gane against Curtis Blaydes is a much more interesting fight now than it ever was before. But of course, Tai Tuivasa doesn't fight like that whatsoever. So again, for Gane, this fight to me comes down to how confident is Cyril Gane in his own abilities. Because let's say he is a little bit hesitant. Let's say even in his mind, he's like, okay, I didn't think Francis was ever going to shoot a takedown. Maybe Tai Tuivasa is going to shoot a takedown. No, I don't believe that's going to happen. But still, for Gane, that last fight was such an anomaly in his career that you really don't know what version of him we're going to get this time around. I still believe he's a more technical fighter than Tai Tuivasa, even though I do agree with you. Tuivasa has been able to tighten up a lot of his own technique on this recent run, but I do like the kicking game out of Cyril Gane. I just don't know where Cyril Gane fits in the division now, because I still love his technique. I really like his volume striking. But is he the second best? Because, again, I think Curtis Blades has a pretty good claim to being, 2B, I guess, in this weight class, not 2A. But I do think that there's more interesting matchups out there for Ciryl Gane now than I ever thought there was going into that title fight against Francis.
I mean, when I do look at this one, if you look at it for Tuivasa in the recent run, we'll pick on some of these five fights. He knocks out Stefan Struve, who
retired basically immediately after.
He knocked out Harry Hunsucker, who came in on really short notice. He knocked out Greg Hardy, which was a really good one because they both threw with power in that one. He knocked out Augusto Sakai.
He did look good there.
And Sakai, poor guy, fought four losses in a row from a guy who was 15-1-1 at one point. And he knocked out Derek Lewis in a fight where Derek Lewis fighting at Houston used to be a great thing and then all of a sudden turned out to be a nightmare. And Tuivasa looked really good in that matchup as well. So Tuivasa's evolved. He's continued to win. For Ciryl Gane, I see it out there. I see it on the internet, the Twitters, the YouTube comment section. The guy is a point fighter, this and that. And you can point to his fights against Rozenstruik and Volkov to where he's switching stances. He's peppering in his power shots with his non-power shots. He took the power of Volkov in that fight. He did incredibly well. But remember the fight that he had against Derek Lewis where he threw with a lot of power. Remember the fight against JDS where he's landing the elbows.
JDS was 45.
Remember his fight against Hodger Souza, against Adam Dykstra over with TKO where he was just throwing with nonstop power. His fight against Tanner Boser, a little bit more of that point karate style. His fight against Dontael Mays, mixing it up at all three levels, taking it to the mat, finishing it by heel hook. We've seen different evolutions of Ciryl Gane's game, and you got to realize, too, this is a guy that had the kickboxing experience coming into MMA. He's only had 11 pro fights, and he came into the UFC at what? 3-0, 4-0, 4-0 at the time. So we have a look at the odds in this one. Gane opened a minus 300 favorite, minus 571. For Tai Tuivasa, open plus 250, plus 412. We have a look at your comments in the YouTube community tab. This was thrown out there yesterday. 1,500 total votes. You folks are dedicated. 75% with Gane to the 25% that have Tuivasa. Akash Deep always doing the damn thing in the comment section. I think Ciryl bounces back with a late finish. Pick him apart at distance, kind of like what JDS did. Mike is saying Gane is an excellent game to counter Ty. He's got every physical advantage and can keep Ty at range all night long. But we've never seen Gane hit with a few solid bombs to the chin. I'd offer a little bit of a counter.
Bill, no says, one who can hit as hard as Tuivasa, though.
No, but we've never seen Gane hit with a few solid bombs to the chin. Volkov is able to do it. Chad, the UFC dad, new school versus old school. Ty's got to punch his chance heavyweight division, and that's all it takes sometimes. And Russ is saying Ciryl's going to piece him up. So, Matt, the fans going with Gane, the odds overwhelmingly going with Gane. I'm also going with Gane, but what do you have to say here?
I'm going with Gane, but I'm going to lay out a game plan for why I think Tai Tuivasa has a much better chance than the majority of people have laid out. And it's not just because of my roulette theory. It's nothing like that. Like, again, Tai Tuivasa, if he landed clean against Francis, would probably knock him out. Like, he would knock out any fighter in the heavyweight division if he lands a clean shot. This is why I think Tuivasa can have a unique advantage, though. Ciryl Gane likes to be really far away from his opponents, or he likes to be really close to them and brutalize them in the clinch. I don't think he's going to have a clinch advantage over Tai Tuivasa, though. I actually think Tuivasa is going to have a lot of dirty boxing opportunities in the clinch. He's got really good elbows of his own, too, in that really close range distance. We saw him finish Derek Lewis in a range like that, so I do think there's a world where Tai Tuivasa can have success on the feet, but again, it's all predicated on him getting on the inside of Ciryl Gane, and the only person who's ever been able to do that at the UFC level is a wrestling Francis Ngannou. So I do think Gane has fought opponents who get him ready for this style of fight, but Tai Tuivasa at plus 400 is kind of a weird amount of odds because, again, for the reasons I laid out, he could win via knockout in the first 10 seconds, he could win via knockout in the last 10 seconds, and he could get outclassed for every single moment in between those two. So I think this is a really fun fight. It should be an interesting fight, but this does feel like a hometown welcoming for Ciryl Gane.
A zig and a zag for Tuivasa. He does have a lot of success behind that black line up against the cage. Bigger cage in this one as well, but for Tuivasa, we saw it against Augusto Sakai, where that used to be Sakai's world, and then all of a sudden, Tuivasa was able to punch, push him back against the cage, finish him. He was able to do the same thing against Derek Lewis. For Ciryl Gane, he will clinch at the center of the octagon, so it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out. You like the knees, the stance switches, the long-range attacks. For those reasons, I like Ciryl Gane. We have a great main event coming up this weekend. 7 debuting fighters on this card, including a pair of debuting fighters and William Gomez taking on Jarno Ahrens to start the card off. If you don't know some of these fighters, check out the videos here on the channel. Monday night, Dana White's Contender Series videos coming out. We do the live video every single time for the fights that are on Tuesday. Some big time matchups coming up week number 6 this week. Matt, some great fights coming up this weekend. What are just some of the ones that you're looking forward to?
Shao Jourdain versus Nathaniel Wood is a very important fight for the 145 pound division. Shao Jourdain has been close to the top 15, but he's never really been able to get his feet firmly planted inside the rankings. And for Nathaniel Wood, he was a top tier prospect kind of contender at the 135 pound division who looked good in his featherweight debut, but there's a big difference between Charles Rosa and Shao Jourdain, so I think that's a fight that it might not be flying under the radar, but it's definitely getting the hype that it deserves, hopefully on this channel at least.
Yeah, and I really do think you're not going to want to miss Benoit Saint-Denis taking on Gabriel Miranda. Miranda's jiu-jitsu is of that ilk, but he hasn't fought a good level of competition, and for Benoit Saint-Denis, he's fought that level of competition, struggled against Elize Uzelesky dos Santos, sent the green mask Nicolas Stutz out of the UFC's last time out. That should be a really fun fight. Make sure you check out those videos, support the channel, comment as you can, and let us know who you have in some of these fights, and a like is appreciated as well. We got a great week coming up, and question mark kicks, of course, 2 hours before the prelims on Saturday. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.